Hare Krishna. So today we will we come to the last lap of our short marathon. So just like in a marathon, sometimes the runners run a little slowly in the beginning and then they run fast. So like that, we have picked up speed yesterday. Today we will have to complete the remaining. So 12, 13, 14 is another set, and in structure and theme, this three-verse set is similar to the three-verse set that we just completed. So the 9 to 11 talked about Vidya and Avidya, 12 to 14 talk about Sambhuti and Asambhuti. So let's recite the 12th verse. How will it start?
Antama pravashanti ye sambhutim upasate tato bhuya eva te tamo yau sambhutyam rataha.
So it's exactly similar. There's a vidya vidya, he sambhuti asambhuti. Yeah. This translation. So sambhuti, this word is in Sanskrit somewhat ambiguous. Sambhava refers to what? Creation. Of course, sambhava in Hindi means possibility, but sambhava in Sanskrit, it generally means creation. So sambhava, bhava sambhava lopahetu yastad konvatthate akhilagaro bhagavan prayasa. Uttarane yasya bhava sambhava lopaheto. Prahlad Maharaj is saying that, my dear Lord, it is not difficult for you to deliver us, to destroy the conditioning of one soul, because you destroy the whole material existence. You create it, you maintain it, you destroy it. Sambhava. So, bhava we know is creation, material creation. Sambhava means to create. So, sambhuti refers to the ground of creation. That means the platform from which things are created. So, sambhuti refers to that sense of the absolute truth. This is one of the verses where different acharyas in our sampradaya, as well as different scholars who translate the Upanishads, have often given different translations. But sambhuti, it can logically be understood to mean absolute truth. So, we'll focus on what Srila Prabhupada has used. So, Andham tamah pravishanti ye asambhutim upasate. So those who worship that which is not the absolute truth, tato bhuya eva te tamo yev sambhutyam rataha. And even more detrimental or more ill-fated are those who mistake something else to be the absolute truth. So, Srila Prabhupada talks in the first category about the demigods. Those who worship the demigods are worshipping asambhuti. And those who worship the impersonal absolute, they think that they are worshipping the ultimate absolute truth. So they are sambhutyamrataha. They are worshipping the so-called absolute truth. So this is purport has these three sections, very systematic again. So first point Srila Prabhupada starts with, that people don't know, understand what is the absolute truth. And he elaborates on that. And then he goes into, so he's first clarifying and elaborating the word sambhuti. How it means the absolute truth, people don't understand the absolute truth. Then he goes into the two category of people are talked over there. First, asambhutim rataha and sambhutyam rataha. Asambhutim upasate and sambhutyam rataha. That's the overall flow of the purport. Now, like we discussed in the previous verse, previous set of verses, how different 9, 10, 11 use the same words vidya and avidya, but had different meanings. So like that here also 12, 13, 14 use the same words, but they have different meanings. Can I go to the next slide? Those of you who have laptops, I think this PPT is also available. You can keep it with you. So, in this verse, Asambhuti refers to demigod, Sambhuti refers to the impersonal absolute. So in the next verse, Anyadevahu Sambhavad, Anyadahur Sambhavad. So there, Sambhuti refers to the absolute truth and Asambhuti refers to anything other than absolute truth. So that can include the demigods, that can include the impersonal Brahman also, both. And then in the next verse, Sambhutim cha vinasham cha yastadvedo bhayam saha. There, Asambhuti, like earlier in the section, Avidya referred to knowledge of how to live in the material world. Similarly, here Asambhuti refers to knowledge of the material world and Sambhuti refers to knowledge of the spiritual world. So by knowing the nature of the material world, we can detach ourselves, at the same time knowing how to live here harmoniously. And then, by knowing the Supreme Lord, we become attracted to Him and we return back to Him. So let's go over this now. So again, the words are multivalent. Same word, different meanings. And that's why we need the overall broad philosophy to understand what words mean. When we study scripture, there are two issues to be discussed. One is the text, and the second is the context. So, academic translators often focus only on the text without considering the context. And from the text point of view, okay, this word means this. That's the dictionary meaning. So, that way, their translations might be grammatically defensible, but they are not culturally intelligible. The two things are different. Grammatically defensible, for example, Max Müller translates a passage from, I think, the Rig Veda, one of the Vedic literature, that the sannyasi will attain success in his sannyas by daily slaughtering cows. Now, this from the cultural point of view is outrageous. Now if you go and look at the original Sanskrit, what it is? It is actually talking about how the word used is go. And the sannyasi has to cut down his senses. So the word go means senses, the word go means cows. Now from the grammatical point of view, you can say go can mean cows. Fine, it can mean cow, so it's grammatically defensible, but it's culturally entirely unintelligible. Indians, those who follow the Vedic, they can't comprehend cow slaughter. So that's why, without a familiarity with the overall culture, the culture is just to, for the sake of the rhyming, text and context. So without the context, when we take the text, it can lead to misunderstanding. And even in the Bhagavatam, although the Bhagavatam is ultimately teaching the absolute truth, not every verse in the Bhagavatam is teaching the absolute truth. When Krishna himself is speaking, but he's speaking karma mamsa at times. This is the context. We understand that this is not the ultimate message. Like, say, in the Prahlad Maharaj pastime, when Hiranyakashipu sees Brahma, he glorifies him as if he's the supreme. But Brahma is not the supreme. Brahma is not the lord of the three modes. Brahma is not the supreme among all beings. So we have to see the context. So yes, every verse in the Bhagavatam is important. But every verse in the Bhagavatam may not be giving the conclusive understanding of the Bhagavatam. And that way we see that even Shukdev Goswami, while talking to Parikshit Maharaj, first test him by giving an intimate answer. He first says that, what is the way to atone for sins or to become free from sins? First atonement. And then Shukadeva says, no, this won't work. Then he says, absorb yourself in jnana. And then he tells the final truth. Abdu bhakti. This happens in the sixth chanto, first chapter. So after the description of the hellish planets in the fifth canto end. So the point is that without the context, the text can be violently misinterpreted. This is not just an inaccurate translation, it is a violent misrepresentation to say that the sannyasi should slaughter cows to attain success in sannyas. So of course today that sort of terrible mistranslation may not be there. But still, because of lack of cultural sensitivity, some translations may go a little far off. And therefore we need to have the context in mind. And when we understand that the Upanishad is talking about the absolute truth, at that point, overall the Upanishads are searching for the absolute truth. So, from the context point of view, the word Sambhuti is reasonably meaning the absolute truth. Okay, so let's move forward now. So basically, demigod worship is one of the most criticized aspects of Vedic culture within the Western intellectual context, especially the Christian intellectual context. So Christianity, generally the Abrahamic religions, they criticize strongly three things about Vedic culture. First is idolatry. Second is what they call as polytheism. And third is the discriminative caste system. These are the three targets of criticism that they have. So we discussed how idolatry is not what the Vedic literature is doing. The deity worship is very different from idolatry. Then we also discussed how caste system as it exists today is a perversion of what had originally existed earlier. And now regarding polytheism, this is a topic which has to be carefully dealt with. Because there is misunderstanding about this even within the Indian tradition. Even within followers of today's Hinduism, they misunderstand this. What is actually the conclusion? And this misunderstanding was also a cause of the popularity of Mayavad. Because if somebody says Shiva is supreme, somebody else says Durga is supreme, somebody else says Krishna is supreme, then if we say that Shiva is supreme, then we will be seen as sectarian. If we say Krishna is supreme, we will be seen as sectarian. So what the Mayavadis thought is, or rather what the politicians who during the Indian independence struggle wanted to use India's religious culture as a political tool. Later on I'll just briefly discuss about how Mayavad spread in India during medieval and modern times. So what happened in the pre-modern times, when the British were ruling India and Indians were awakening to their struggle for independence. So the Indian political leaders saw that one of the greatest galvanizing force for Indians would be religion. So if we have to unite Indians religiously, then there needs to be a common platform. But what is the common platform for Indians to be united religiously? Because even within the Indian religious tradition, there is so much diversity. Yesterday I was telling some devotees that the Supreme Court was the issue of Hinduism. You know, who is a Hindu? When this had to be decided, that is such a debatable issue because there is such a wide variety of people who practice what is called as Hinduism, that when the issue came up to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court at one time gave a judgment that anybody who lives in India is not a Christian, and who is not a Christian, Muslim, Parsi, Sikh, he is a Hindu. So, this is an application in the legal field of Naiti Naiti. But the problem with this is that this denies that Hinduism, despite its mind-boggling variety, as one Western scholar who came to India, he says, Hinduism is not a religion. Hinduism is a museum of religions. There are so many things that go on, especially if we go to Kumbh Mela, you know, what we tell in DYS about supermarket of religions. You can practically see that, all the variety that is there. But still, in spite of that, what goes on in the name of Hinduism today still has some major similarities. You know, almost all Hindus believe in karma, in reincarnation, in the concept that Atma lives after death, in the understanding that the deities are some way divine. Either some may think by ascending symbolism, others by descending symbolism. But deities are some way divine. The concept of deity worship is more or less accepted by all Hindus. Similarly, there is the idea that certain places are holy and sacred, certain rivers are sacred. This is there in other religious traditions also, but not so much. And further that, there is overall respect for the Vedic scriptures. The overall respect for the Vedic scriptures. So what happened was, when the Indian independence struggle was going on, so the roots for what is today RSS were laid by several people. One of them was Savarkar, then there was Golwalkar. And there are several people like that who... So Savarkar wrote a book called Hindutva. So what defines a Hindu? That was the issue. So he said, if we look at theological beliefs, they're so varying. Some Hindus consider God to be personal, some to be impersonal. And some consider God to be this person, God to be that person. So generally, religions are united by at least some broad theological agreement. But if on Hindus, there is practically no theological agreement. Then he said, okay, what else can we have? Can we look at cultural similarity? But there is such tremendous cultural diversity. Can we look at language? There is so much wideness in language. So he went over all the parameters. Now, ideally speaking, the parameter that should have been considered is faith in Vedic scriptures. Faith in Vedic scriptures. But he analyzed that and he said that actually, if we define as Hindu one who has faith in Vedic scriptures, then we will have to leave out of our fold our Buddhist and Jain brothers. And somehow his idea, so he said that how do we define a Hindu? He said a Hindu is that person who considers whose holy places, whose lands of sanctity lie in the geographical area of India. That was his definition. So he said, for Christianity, for Islam, their holy places lie outside India. And because of that, their religious affection detracts from their nationalistic sentiment. So we see this literally many times when an India-Pakistan match is going on, many Muslims cheer Pakistan. This is a very gross and simplistic example, but his point was that, you know, his whole goal was to make India nationalistic, to arouse the nationalistic fervor in people. And he felt that, to some extent it may be true also, that Buddhism and Jainism have not harmed Indian culture as much as have Christianity and Islam, that is, at least in the recent centuries. So therefore he said that criteria for defining a Hindu is who? That person whose holy lands are in the geographical boundaries of India. So now this definition practically divested Hinduism of any philosophical or theological significance. So that is how Hinduism became equated with nationalism. So yesterday I talked about how Srila Prabhupada considers nationalism to be a bad quality. Now nationalism in and of itself is something similar to what was there in the Vedic times when a king would protect his state or his country. And that is important. Now, a king protecting his country is also dharma. But it is not paradharma. It is not paradharma. It is upadharma. Just like there is in many Hindu society, in Hindu communities, there is some form of ancestor worship. Now, people may have photos of their ancestors, and not only, they may sometimes offer some udbatti to it, some incense to it. So that the idea that one belongs to a lineage that one is proud of, that is mentioned even in the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna is referred to as Partha or Kaunteya or Kurunandana, Bharatarshabha, which is all fine. But these are bodily designations, and they are never considered to be paradharma. They are aparadharma, or upadharma we can say. So in the aparadharma, in the 7th canto they talk, there are varieties of categories. The chaladharma, upadharma, and like that, many categories are there. So this is the Upadharma. It is a subordinate religion. It is important in one sense because every country has to protect its boundaries. But by protecting its boundaries, the ultimate purpose is to protect its citizens. And protection of the citizens doesn't just mean their material protection, it is also their spiritual protection. So when Maharaj Yudhishthir is performing the Ashwamedha Rajasuya Yajna, he does both. Firstly, performs the Rajasuya, then he performs the Ashwamedha also. So when he does that, the purpose is not to disrupt geographical boundaries of various kingdoms. In fact, we will see most of the times that even when a particular king refuses to accept the authority of the Kauravas, of the Pandavas, then say whoever is the Pandava warrior is gone, say Arjuna, he will fight with that king. And after that king gets defeated, if the king is killed in the fight, then Arjuna will usually install his son as the king and tell him, you offer tributes to us and you continue as the king. Or if that king himself accepts defeat, then he is told, you continue as the king. It's not that the Pandavas themselves become the rulers over there. So the idea is that even the Pandavas respected some nationalistic boundaries. We can say nationalistic in the sense that the boundaries of particular states. So when they expanded their kingdom, it was more in terms of they becoming emperors. That means kings of kings. Not just they taking over the kingdom and taking the administration for themselves. From practical point of view, it is not possible for one king to administer the whole world. And the king also needs the assistance of other Kshatriyas. So in that sense, the idea of having boundaries and protecting boundaries and respecting geographical boundaries is not wrong. But it was never elevated to the level of an absolute religious ideal. It is considered to be a duty, but it's a subordinate duty. And there is a higher duty beyond that. So in the Indian independence struggle, so when these people came along, they felt that if you have to unite India, religion is a very good way to unite India. And so they decided one criteria for uniting Indians is nationalism. Like, all those people whose sacred eye, he was a poetic writer, he says, whose sacred eye does not go beyond the holy land of India. So, that means the eye that is looking for the sacred, they see it within India, they are Hindus. So by this, he said, we include Buddhists and Jains and other people also. But then, after that, we make this definition, there has to be some theological agreement. So how do we get theological agreement? Theological means the concept of God and concept of absolute truth. So they said, we'll get this by declaring the Brahman to be the absolute truth. And by having all the gods as faces on the Brahman. Brahman is faceless, but you put a face on Brahman so that you can develop a relationship with him. So the idea is that all the forms, this is basically Mayavad in its modern version. So earlier, Mayavad was propagated for the purpose of refuting Buddhism. But now, Mayavad is propagated for the purpose of promoting nationalism. And in this situation, the whole concept of polytheism and worshipping many gods being seen as an embarrassment, it was on one side internally divisive and externally embarrassing. Internally divisive means, oh, so many Indians will get divided into so many sects. Buddhists, Shaivites, Vaishnavites, all this, Shaktas, sorry, not Buddhists, Vaishnavas, Shaivites, Shaktas, and externally embarrassing. You people, you worship so many gods. You don't have any common sense that God means supreme and supreme can only be one. You don't even have that much intelligence. This was a criticism of the Abrahamic religions. And it's true, the supreme has to be only one. So in the Christian tradition, and even in the Abrahamic tradition, the concept of, they have gods with a capital G and gods in the plural, with a small g. But their understanding of gods is different from our understanding of demigods. Their understanding is that the other gods are false gods. And they are competitors of the true God. And therefore, our devotion to the true God is shown by our destruction of the false gods. Not just by our rejection of the false gods, but by our destruction of the false gods. So in the Vedic culture, The demigods are not false gods. They are not even competitor gods. They are assistant gods. So, although the same word gods in the plural might be used, the conception is different. So, occasionally, some Puranas might describe some stories where certain devatas are seen to be competing with Krishna or Vishnu for supremacy. But then, overall, the conclusion is clear. So, therefore, the idea is very different. So, the Vedic culture never accepts polytheism in the sense of there being many supremes. So, Max Muller is a very prominent historian who came to India with the explicit intention. Actually, he didn't even come to India. He studied Indian literature with the explicit intention of misinterpreting the Indian literature, by which people's faith in the Indian literature would be lost. And he did a huge amount of work. From the hard work point of view, he worked very hard. But overall, he did a lot of misinterpretation. Unfortunately, even today, he is considered to be like the father of Indology. And many Indian cities, if they have an Indological center, it is named as Max Muller Bhavan. Very unfortunate. There are direct quotes of his where he writes to his wife, and he's saying that, he writes a letter, he tells that, you know, I may not live to see the success of the work that I am doing, but I am confident that the work that I am doing will destroy the pagan beliefs at their foundation, so that they can soon be illuminated by the light of the Bible. So his agenda was clearly religious, and he was intelligent, so he did not directly criticize the Vedic literature. What he did was, he would appreciate it, and he was basically a proponent of, you remember I talked about three approaches of Christianity towards Hinduism: condemnation, irrelevance, and fulfillment. So he focused primarily on fulfillment. You say, oh, there are flashes of brilliance in the Indian literature. But unfortunately, these flashes of brilliance lead to no sustained illumination, but to a profound darkness. That can be removed only by the light of the Bible. So, he was charitable, condescendingly charitable, by saying that, yeah, there are some good points in it, but overall it is inconclusive, it is incoherent. So he coined a new term to describe Hindu religion. That is a term called henotheism. What is henotheism? So henotheism means that, actually speaking, there is one God, but he manifests in different forms. And all the various forms are just manifestation of that one God. So there is one reality. So the idea is that he thought that some Hindus, whenever they want, they will glorify Shiva as supreme. Whenever they want, they will glorify Vishnu as supreme. Whenever they want, they will glorify Shakti as supreme. And we see this sometimes happening in India. You know, people go on different days to different demigod temples and worship them. So as if the supremacy is like a tenure bound position which is changing every day of the week. Isn't it? So, just like, you know, I don't know if everybody understood what I said. The tenure bound position means just like a politician is elected. So, he is president for 4 years or five, prime minister for 4 years, 5 years, then his tenure changes. Then somebody else becomes the prime minister. So, like that, they think the position of the supreme god is changes its tenure. So Monday, this God is supreme. So Tuesday, this God is supreme. Wednesday, this God is supreme. Thursday, this God is supreme. Like that. So, it's something strange. You know, spiritualists think of who am I? Materialists think of what is my? They don't think who am I, who is God. They only think what is my? So, whichever demigod I go to, if I get something from that, that's great. So, who is supreme? That is not my issue only. So it's like that. So people don't think about who is supreme. What they focus on is, what is my? What can become my? they're really not having any deep philosophical questions many times. So anyway, now let's try to understand what actually is the principle behind demigod worship. So we understood that it is an object of criticism, how it was removed. It was tried to be sidelined by enthroning Brahman as supreme, and how it was labeled by the Western people as henotheism, which is also one form of saying the same thing. There is an impersonal supreme which manifests in different forms at different times. So, now Krishna gives the, this is Radhishyam Prabhu's PPT, I just modified it substantially to add some more points in it. So now, so let's start from this point. One of the defining features of Vedic spirituality is that it is user friendly. Now what does user friendly mean? See, ultimately in spiritual life, there are two things. There is sadhana and there is sadhya. There is the means and there is the goal. So if you look at the Abrahamic religions, the means and goals are fixed. So what is the goal? The goal is to go back to Jannat. And what is the means? Accept Muhammad as the seal of all prophets. So only one way and only one goal. Now, in the Vedic culture, it is understood that different people are at different levels of spiritual evolution. Different people have different psychophysical natures. Their mind, their bodies are different. So they cannot all uniformly accept one absolute truth. So therefore, flexibility is given. Whatever means you want to follow, you follow that means. Whatever goal you want to aspire for, you aspire for that goal. So the flexibility in sadhana, sadhana means means. So sadhana is, when we apply ourselves to the means, it is called a sadhana. Sadhana is the means itself. So there are four sadhanas, broadly speaking. There is karma, jnana, yoga and bhakti. And earlier we discussed how karma will take us to swarga, jnana will take us to Brahman, yoga will take us either to Brahman or to Bhagavan, depending on what we think of Paramatma to be. Either we understand the Paramatma to be ourselves or to be a distinct person who is to be served. And bhakti will take us to Vaikuntha. So, in one sense, it's not that all of them are equal. But they are different levels. And according to what is a person's individual nature, the person is given flexibility. And like that, in sadhya also, there are different sadhyas which I mentioned. You can worship Vishnu, you can worship Brahma, you can worship Vishnu, you can worship Durga. That flexibility is given. So what happens by this flexibility, that people who are at various levels of spiritual evolution, they can all be accommodated in the house of religion. In the Abrahamic religions, what happens is, the entry step for the house of religion becomes very steep. Either you accept this God, then you come in the religion. If you don't accept it, you are irreligious and you are going to go to hell. So what happens is, the Vedic culture extends the boundaries of the house of religion far, so that many people, even if they don't accept the Supreme Lord as the one supreme, still they can be accommodated within the house of religion. So in that sense, it's more broad and accommodating. Now, the sadhans, multiple sadhana and multiple sadhya, let's move forward. Now let's try to understand what is the... We are not going to discuss about sadhana now. We are going to discuss about sadhya a little later. Questions. We will discuss about sadhya. Sadhana we will discuss a little later. Although we have discussed much of it. So sadhya. So in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Yajnavalkya is asked this question. Kati devaha. How many gods are there? And he goes very interesting. He says 3003 gods. Then he says 303 gods. Then 33 gods. Okay, now, how many gods are there? Again, he asks. 6 gods. How many gods are there? 3. How many gods? 2. How many gods? 1. And he answers as if there is no contradiction between these answers. What does this mean? That means that actually that one God is manifesting as many. It may be three, it may be 3003, whatever. Now, of course, all manifestations are not of the same level. Some may be Swamisha, some may be Vibhinnasha. But ultimately, there is this clear understanding that there is one absolute truth that is manifesting as many. It's not that there are many absolute truths. It's not that there are absolute truths who are competing with the other, who is absolute. There is no such conception. So there is one and there is many. So there are the many who are the manifestations of the one. And there may be varying degrees of manifestation. So here also is another example of the person being given an answer according to his, how much he is persisting. So first he is given an external answer, then a slightly deeper answer. And finally if he keeps persisting, he is given the deepest answer. No, Yajnavalkya is asked this question. So the seeker. No, a seeker asks Yajnavalkya the question. Yajnavalkya is asked the question. So now let's look at why there are so many gods. Now, actually these three, four verses from the seventh chapter are extremely important. 7.20 to 23. Now, most of us have heard these verses. But let us look at them from this previous Brihadaranyaka Upanishad point of view. 7.20, we know this verse. What is Krishna telling? Let's recite the verse together. Kama istaistai rita jnana prapadyante nya devata tam tam niyamam asthaya prakritya niyata swaya. Yes. So now, one thing is very clear from this verse. Krishna does not accept henotheism. Krishna is not saying that there is one absolute truth which is manifesting as many. What is Krishna saying? Anya devataha. He is clearly saying that. It is not that everything is one in the absolute sense. See? That there are anya devataha. Anya apart from him. Because the previous Shruti has talked about maam prapadyante, maam upasati. He is talking about that. So he clearly says that there are different gods. And people surrender to those gods. So how does it work? Then he describes how the process of demigodism works. What is the motivating reason? It is their kama istaisthiritayana. It is according to their desires. Their material desires are very strong. And what does it mean? Ritagyana? Their jnana about what is the absolute truth that is lost. When kama is very strong, a person is not interested in the absolute truth. For him, the object of enjoyment itself is the absolute truth. This is what I want. I don't care for anything else. So in that sense, for when Bilvamangal Thakur was going to that Chintamani, you know, there was a snake, there was a corpse. But for him, they didn't exist only. For him, the only truth was that I had to go to Chintamani. And for that purpose, whatever is there, it's a tool. So he thought it was a log, it's a rope. He didn't notice. So like that, even material desires create vyavasayatmika buddhi ekeha kurunanda. One-pointedness. So this one-pointedness also leads to distractedness from everything else. So that's why this jnana is destroyed. So most demigod worshippers don't really seriously think about who is the absolute truth. What they're concerned is, can I get my sense gratification? So then, what happens when they're worshipped? It's the next verse. Yo yo yam yam tanum bhakta shraddhayarchitum icchati tasya tasya chalam shraddham tameva vidadhamyaham. So now here Krishna is telling, whoever you try to worship, yo yo yam yam tanum. So again, what does the word tanu mean? Form. Whichever form you worship. So I make your faith strong in that. I make your shraddha architum ichyati. You desire to worship. Tasya tasya. For that form, achalam shraddham. Faith becomes achala. Chanchala and achala. I make the faith strong. For tam eva vidadhamya. I give that achala shraddha to that person. So now this is very opposite to the biblical idea. The biblical idea, God is telling, go and destroy all the false gods. One of their commandments is, you should worship no god except the true God. So the idea is that there are false gods also and they should be rejected. But Krishna is telling, I am giving faith in your heart to worship these false gods. Now this is the translation of this verse is also an example of Prabhupada giving us the context. Now if you see, what Srila Prabhupada adds in the translation of 7.21 is, I am present as the super soul in everyone's heart. And you say, where is the super soul? There is no mention of super soul. But Krishna is saying, I give the faith. So how do I give the faith? He later tells Mattas Mitriyanam Apohanam Cha. So the Prabhupada is adding that to clarify things over here for us. Now, why is it that Krishna gives faith? Before we answer this question, let's see what further Krishna does.
Sataya shraddhaya yuktas tasya radhanam ihate labhate chitatah kama mayaiva vihitan hitan.
So now what is sataya shraddhaya yuktas? Equipped with that faith, tasya aradhanam ihate. They worship that particular demigod. And then labhate, they get their kaam. But who is giving it? Mayaiva vihitan hitan. It is I only who am giving it to them. And then Krishna says, okay. Then is there any difference if you only are giving the fruit? So Krishna is giving the faith, Krishna is giving the fruit. So you wonder, what is the problem? Krishna says, there is a problem. What is that? One is temporary, the other is permanent. Antavat phalam tesham tadbhavatyalpa medhasam devan devayajo yanti madbhakta yanti mamapi.
Translation is, most of you know this, it's all temporary, the fruits are temporary, and the unwise people, the alpamedhasa, less intelligent people worship this.
And they will go to the devatas and my bhakti devotees will come to me. So again, one thing is clear here, Krishna does not support the idea that all the gods are one. He very clearly says there are different gods, but he also says that I am giving faith to them. So now let's understand how this is different from polytheism as it is understood in the Western tradition.
So, in polytheism, there is one god here, and there is another god here. And both of them cannot get along.
So, both of them are fighting with the other. That is the idea. That is the Western idea of polytheism.
But here what Krishna is saying, there is one god here, supreme. And you know, multiple gods, and then there are their worshippers. This is demigods and their worshippers. And interestingly,
God and his worshippers also directly.
But all of these together are in the fold of Vedic culture. This is Vedic culture, this is Vaishnava culture.
Is it visible over there? So now, let us see how things are happening in this. See, here there are the demigod worshippers, and there are the demigods.
So now from here, worship will go up. And from here, blessings will go down.
So for worship to go up, faith is required. For blessings to come down, power is required. And Krishna is telling, I give faith. And Krishna is saying, I give power. So, in one sense, this is like match fixing. You know? So, Krishna is telling, I make the faith strong by which you will be able to worship the devatas, and I give the fruits to the power to the demigods by which they will be able to give you fruits. Then you wonder, why does Krishna do all these things? You know, why don't people just worship me? Why doesn't he do that? Now, Krishna does that in the end. When sarva dharma pratyaje mam ekam sharanam, just worship me, he says that. But again, the point is progression. Not everybody is in a position to worship the Supreme Lord. Because different people are of different modes. And because different people are in different modes, just like we'll see in sports, in movies, different people are attracted to different sports stars, different movie stars. Why? Because their nature is like that. And therefore, according to who they are attracted to, Krishna says, you can worship them accordingly. Krishna says, you can worship them accordingly. And what will happen by this? If the souls are too envious to worship Krishna at this stage, then when they are too envious to worship Krishna, if Krishna does, either you worship me or you go to hell. Then they will be forced to go to hell. Because they are not yet ready to worship Krishna. So Krishna says, okay, if you can't worship me, I will offer you substitute objects of worship. And the substitutes are not equivalent substitutes. They are subordinate substitutes. But they are substitutes. What will happen by that? You will get gradually elevated. So Krishna, in one sense, I talked earlier about the user friendliness. So the user friendliness is manifested by, okay, whatever you are suitable to, what you find suitable, you do that, and by that you will get elevated. By that you will get elevated. So this is the system of demigod worship. Now, over a period of time, the demigod worshippers will gradually come to understand that the supreme is Krishna. So let us see some examples of how this has happened. So now, is this part till now clear? What is described over here? So Krishna has created a system of demigod worship to accommodate those who are not yet ready to worship him. Okay. Can you vibe this? So now I will draw another diagram which will explain how there is a progression in this. So in the Western religious tradition, there is a story of the prodigal son. Most of us know that story, that son of a wealthy father leaves home and is suffering, you know, eating pig food. And then he thinks, let me go back to the father. And when he goes back to the father, father welcomes him with open arms. Now we tell only this much of the story, but actually the story is quite complex. What is the father says, oh, my son has come back. And he says, cut a bull today and offer a feast to the whole village. And then the father says, my son will be the prince of my kingdom. And then there's the older brother who has served the father faithfully. The older brother is like, I served you so long. And you never said that I'll become the prince. And this brother just come back and is saying, he'll become the prince. And the older brother gets very angry. And then scholars give various interpretations. They say the younger brother has a repentant heart, but the older brother is a ritualistic worshipper. And the whole purpose of the story is lost over there. So the point is that we may use Yukta Vairagya. We may use Yukta Vairagya and take a broad features of the story. But you know, they have their own complexities in it. So anyway, the principle is in agreement that even if we reject God, and after rejecting God, we go away from Him. When we return back to Him, He welcomes us. That is the love of God. But in the Vedic tradition, God's love is revealed even more. Even more in the sense that, say, the father is a king. And the son says that, I don't want to stay in your kingdom. I want to go away. So the son goes out of the father's kingdom to some other kingdom. And there he is serving some landlord. Some wealthy person is trying to get money from him and trying to etch a living. So at that time, what does the father do? Now this is the prodigal story, prodigal son story, extended to understand the Vedic system of demigod worship. So what does the father do? The father knows that my son is still foolishly angry with me. Son will not come back to me. So what he does is, he sends a minister from his kingdom who is also landlord under the king. This landlord goes to the son and tells him, see, you are serving this landlord. He's not feeding you properly. He's not giving you proper money. You come and serve me. I will give you a proper salary. So by this, what happens?
Okay. This is the father's view. And the son has got into some other thing. So putting it this way now.
basically what is happening that he's at the lowest level. He has gone to some other kingdom and the son is serving that landlord. And then what happens? The father sends his minister and tells him, the minister doesn't tell, I'm a minister in this father's kingdom. Because as soon as he will hear that, son will say, I don't want to go back to father's kingdom. Just tell them, you know, you are serving, this landlord is not paying you properly, I'll pay you properly, you come and serve me. And then the son comes back to his father's kingdom. And now he's serving the landlord under his father. He may not even know it. But by that, what has happened? He has once again come back in his father's kingdom. And by coming back in his father's kingdom, he's indirectly under his father's care. So at this stage, the son is not interested in any relationship with his father. He's interested in his own material enjoyment. But for the sake of his material enjoyment, his father has allowed him to come back to, has ensured that he comes back to the kingdom. So, this position where then you're talking about, what you're talking about is the object of service. So who is being served? So this, serving some other master, is like serving a materialist. A worldly materialist. And serving the king's minister is like serving a dead lord. So in this world, people want sense gratification and they will serve some other wealthy person and by that they will try to get their sense gratification. But the Vedic culture says, okay, you want sense gratification? Come back within the father's kingdom. Come back in the house of the Vedas. And there you will get it. So the father has ensured that the son has come closer to him. He has not yet come back to his palace, but he has come back within the kingdom. And then later on the son may find that, oh, I am getting so much salary from this minister. But the minister is serving the king. So then he goes to the king. And he says, can I work for you? And the king will say, are you my son? You come and live with my home. You don't have to work for me. He says, no, I don't want to come and live at your home. I'll work for you. Will you give me salary? It's fine. So this is a demigod worshipper. And this level, where the object of service is the king. That means he's serving Krishna, but for material benefit. That is a sakam bhakta. So this is a demigod worshipper, this is a sakam bhakta. And then later on he understands, why am I serving my father for salary? My relationship with my father is based on love. Then what happens is, he becomes a nishkam bhakta. He starts serving out of love. So this is how slowly the Vedic culture leads the person higher and higher. So first he is, with some other landlord, we can call this as semi-god. Semi-god means, say me God. You have to treat me as God. You know, people may not say that, but every boss feels like that. You have to treat me as God, as I'm your authority. And you have to obey me. So, from semi-god to demi-god to God. That is how the journey progresses. So now let us try to understand his, over here, that what Krishna is saying, mayeva bhitan hitan. So the demigods, when they are giving the fruit to the worshippers, how is it happening? That they are getting the power from Krishna only. Just like the king's minister gets the power from the king. He gets the money from the king. But additionally, if a father does like this for his son, we will think the father is very loving. He is going so much out of his way to get his son back to him. But what makes Krishna even more unique is that Krishna not only empowers the demigods to give fruits on his behalf, but he also inspires people to worship the demigods. So that actually is the expression of Krishna's extraordinary compassion. Because, you know, if say, X person is the CEO of a company, then at that time, if some other Y, you know, if the employees of that company start glorifying some other Y as the CEO of the company, the CEO will be angry. Why are you glorifying him? I'm the CEO. Don't you know that? But what if the CEO lets the people go on like that? And not lets it go on like that, he lets them believe that. He encourages them to believe that. You believe that, why is the CEO? So Krishna is primarily not interested in his own worship. He is interested in our elevation. Krishna is not interested in his own worship. He is interested in our elevation. So, right from being irreligious materialists, if you can become raised to the level of religious materialists, even if you don't accept me as the supreme, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter even if you don't accept me as supreme. Just become elevated. So actually, seen from this point of view, we see demigod worship not as a competition to Krishna, but as an expression of the compassion of Krishna. Krishna is so compassionate that for the sake of elevating the conditioned souls, he allows others to become substitute objects of worship. So this demigod worship is an expression of Krishna's extraordinary compassion. So now, how it is, if, now let's extend this metaphor further. If the father has two sons, and the one son is staying at home, and another son is staying in the another kingdom. So when the son from the other kingdom comes back and starts serving the minister. So what will happen? The father will feel so happy. Oh, now he has come back to the kingdom, he starts serving the minister. And the son who is staying with him says, oh, you are so happy when somebody serves the minister, I will also go and serve the minister. He says, shut up, nonsense. You don't have to go and serve him. Why? Because you are already at a higher level. So, when... So, that means what? When somebody is capable of worshipping Krishna as God, for such people, from such people's point of view, Krishna calls demigod worshippers as alpamedhasam. But from the point of view of materialistic people, demigod worshippers are good. They are much better than them. So it's like, this is the example, if a father has two sons, you know, so one of them gets 80% normally, another gets 40%. So what happens? Now the results have come out, both have got 60% now. So then the son who has got 40% gets 60%. He says, shabash, I'm proud of you. Second son also, father, I have got 60%. Badmash, what did you do? He said, what? I also got 60, also got 60. Why badmash for me and shabash for him? He said, because you were at 80, you came down. So like that, for a materialistic person, if he becomes a demigod worshipper, the Vedic scriptures say, very good, shabash, you become a religious person now. But a Krishna devotee becomes a demigod worshipper, alpamedhasa, badmash. It's like that. So, what is right and what is wrong depends on the level at which a person is. So that's why Krishna may condemn demigod worship, but Krishna has himself said, actually, Vedanta Krit Veda Videva Cham. I have only made the Vedas. And the Vedas only talk about demigod worship. So, if you see that original example that we give of Vedic culture being like the unabridged dictionary and the Abrahamic religions like the pocket dictionary. Now this example may tilt our false ego also. We are so big. But actually speaking, you know, an unabridged dictionary is not easy to use. An unabridged dictionary, sometimes you have one word, and like, I have one dictionary online. So, you know, if you give one word, that one, it may have 275 meanings for that word. And then you do, okay, in the sentence that I'm reading, which meaning applies? And sometimes those two meanings may be contradictory also. Like in English, the word epithet, it can mean glorification, it can mean insult. Same word. So, from the point of view of usability, the unabridged dictionary can be used proficiently only by those who are experienced users. If somebody is not an experienced user, the unabridged dictionary can become a source of confusion. That's why the Vedic literature can be understood only through the experienced user. That is the guru. Without the guru, the Vedic literature become a source of confusion. That's why tadvijnanartham sa gurum eva vigacche. If you want to know that truth, we have to go to the guru. Without going to the guru, these Vedic literature can also become a shabdajal maharanyam na bhuktaye na muktaye. It can become a maharanya. It is not a maharanya, it is a very well directed path. very well thought and well planned path. But we have to know what is the ultimate goal. Without that, we can get completely confused. So now, Vedic, so that's why Vedic system of demigod worship is not exactly polytheism. Polytheism means many gods, but they're not many gods, there's only one god. So it's called as multi-level worship. What is multi-level? Okay, you saw this is supreme. I saw supreme god over here, and below that there are multi-level gods. So it's monotheistic, but it is multi-level. And what does it reveal? It bears just in two things. A unique concern for the individuality of the worshipper. Recognize that every soul is conditioned soul is an individual. And according to his individuality, he will have certain likes. He will have certain attractions. So, that concern, okay, according to his attraction, he should be allowed to worship. A unique concern for the individuality of the worshipper and an unparalleled flexibility of the worshipable in making himself accessible. That means, Krishna doesn't say, you have to worship me only, otherwise you are irreligious. So just like I said, the father makes himself accessible to his minister, through his ministers. So like that, the worshipable Lord makes himself accessible to many people through the system of demigod worship. So I have explained most of this I am talking about in my book Idol Worship and Ideal Worship. Much of it is from there itself. But the point is, this is, if we see it in this way, we see this not as the system of demigod worship, not as a cause, not as a source of confusion, but as an expression of compassion. It's an expression of Krishna's compassion, not a confusion. Confusion comes because we come to Vedic system with our own preconceptions. Now let's see how the system has actually worked in many cases. So now Vallabhacharya, we know, the founder of Pushti Marg, he was earlier a worshipper of Lord Shiva. And one day, he went to the temple of Lord Shiva. He was very frustrated with some things that were going on in his life. And he offered very intense prayers to Lord Shiva. And when he offered those prayers, suddenly Lord Shiva appeared. And he said, I am pleased with your prayers. What do you want? So Vallabha was intelligent. And he said, that give me that which is most dear to you. And when he said that, then he was given a... Lord Shiva gave him a deity of Lord Krishna. So here what do we see? Somebody who worships the demigods with a sincere desire for knowing the absolute truth, that person is elevated to the knowledge of Krishna, or at least the Vishnu Tattva. So this is from Shiva to Vishnu. Then this, we also know the example of Keshav Kashmiri. You know, what happened to him was, he was worshipping Saraswati. And Saraswati made him a Pandit, a world champion Pandit, as Prabhupada says. But then what happened? He was defeated by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And what did? He worshipped Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Saraswati Devi again, and he went to sleep while worshipping her. And crying bitterly. And then he says, did I offend you? Why did you disappoint me like this? You had promised me that I would not be defeated by anyone in the world. Saraswati Devi came in his dream and told him that yes, I promised you, you would not be defeated by anyone in the world. But the person whom you defeated was not of the world. Yes. He is actually the Lord of my Lord. Oh, my greatest blessing is not to make you a world-defeating Pandit, but it is to take you to his lotus feet. Go and surrender to him. Then Keshav Kashmiri went on and became a Vaishnava. Similarly, there is a famous story of Chandidas. Chandidas was a Vaishnava. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also used to listen to his songs. So I was quite curious. You know, if he's a Vaishnava, such a great Vaishnava that Krishna, that even Lord Chaitanya hears his compositions, why is his name Chandidas? So there's a nice story behind it. Chandidas was, as the name suggests, a worshipper of Chandi. And his brother was a Vaishnava. And he was quite wealthy and his brother was quite poor. And both of them used to stay side by side. And he had a big garden in which there were many beautiful flowers. And every day he would offer those flowers to Chandi. So one day, his brother asked him, now can I take some flowers from your garden to offer to my Shalagram Shila? He said, nothing doing. So all my flowers are meant only for Chandi. His brother said, okay. Went away. Next, one day later, early in the morning, his brother was going for a bath and then later coming back. Four times he saw the beautiful flowers and thought, oh, if only I could have some flowers to offer to Shalagram, to Vishnu. And in his mind, he thought like this. In his mind, he offered the flowers to Vishnu. And then Chandidas took those same flowers and offered them to Chandi. And as he was chanting the glories of Chandi, Suddenly Chandi Devi appeared to her. And I am pleased with him. What do you want? Pleased with you. What do you want? Surprised. He said, I'll ask what I want afterward, but please tell me first. I have been worshipping you for so long. How is that today you are pleased? So he said, actually, today you offered me the Mahaprasad of my ultimate Lord. This is what do you mean? He told the whole story. You mean to say worship of Vishnu is superior to worship of you? He said, of course. Vishnu is the Lord of my Lord. My Lord is Shiva, his Lord is Vishnu. Why didn't you tell this to me? He says, you never asked this of me. You are so busy asking, give me this, give me that, you never asked me. But today, you have specially pleased me, because you have offered me the prasad of my Lord. Therefore, I am giving you special blessings. I am revealing to you the absolute truth. So from that time, Chandi Das became a Vaishnava. But when he became a Vaishnava, he considered Chandi to be his guru. And therefore, he kept his name as Chandi Das, but was a Vaishnava. So, like this, in the Vedic tradition, there are many examples of people who are gradually elevated to the worship of Krishna or the Vishnu Tattva through the worship of demigods. And this is how actually the system is profoundly compassionate. Okay, fine. So I'll summarize quickly what I discussed, then we'll have some questions. So I talked initially about how the source of demigod system was seen as an external embarrassment and a source of internal divisiveness by medieval Indian leaders, not my modern or pre-modern Indian leaders. And then we discussed how demigod system, worship system, extend the boundaries of the house of religion beyond what is the in the Abrahamic traditions, either worship God or be religious. Even if you can't worship God, worship his subordinate substitutes and gradually get elevated. And we discussed the example of 40, 60, 80%. We discussed the example of the father, a king, sending his minister to rescue and bring back his estranged son. And then lastly, we discussed about how Krishna gives both the faith and the fruits and how this system of worship can ultimately lead to the worship of Krishna. Yes, Amal Mahaprabhu. When does a person come from demigod worship to Krishna? Ultimately, every path that is transitional can be propagated by its followers as terminal, as final. And when that happens, that can lead to misunderstanding. Just like Brahma, that jnana, the path of jnana is good. It is better than karma. But when jnana is thought of as the highest, it can become troublesome. So similarly, it has happened that there are many demigod worshippers who have sort of considered their demigod only to be supreme. And when that happens, that sometimes unfortunately leads to conflicts between the demigod worshippers and Krishna worshippers sometimes. Or that may lead to that person getting stuck at that level of demigod worship permanently. So ultimately what is required is sincerity of heart. You know, one time there was a Pandal program in Mumbai. So one person asked Radhanath Maharaj this question that there are so many paths and all teachers say that their path is genuine. So how can we know which path is genuine? So Radhanath Maharaj gave a very surprising answer. Of course, when I read Journey Home, I realized it's not surprising, it's authentic. He says, there is no need for you to bother too much about which path is genuine. What you should bother is, are you genuine? Are you genuine? What that means is, are you interested in finding the actual truth? Or are you just interested in justifying that the path you are following is the truth? So if you are interested in the second, then we'll get misled. But if you are interested in the first, then gradually one will get elevated to the highest understanding. That may take some time also. So in some cases, some demigod worshippers may become malevolently opposed to Krishna worshippers. Like we talked about the King Kolatonga persecuting Vaishnavas. And these cases are unfortunate. They happen sometimes. But overall, the system works in such a way that at the very least, large number of people stay religious. Large number of people stay religious. They are kept within the house of religion. And they may not come out to the innermost chambers of that house, but stay within the house of religion. And gradually, they will become elevated. So, what is required for them to elevate further? One is sincerity of purpose. Another additional thing could be if they get the mercy of some devotees. If they get the mercy of some devotee, the devotee gives them the highest understanding. Now, we may say that, okay, we generally say that so-and-so God worship is for so-and-so modes. Shiva is for this mode, Brahma is for this mode, Vishnu is for this mode. Now, we may say that actually the hippies were in the mode of ignorance. Isn't it? Then Srila Prabhupada, in accordance with the culture, had taught them worship of Shiva rather than Vishnu. No. Actually, the real challenge, it's not that everybody in the mode of goodness, ignorance has to worship Shiva. The point is, that is where people in ignorance will be naturally attracted. But the important thing is, a devotee can inspire faith in a person at whatever level he may be. So a person may be in the mode of ignorance and Krishna worship may be transcendental. But if somehow somebody can come in contact with a devotee, and from whatever level he is at, that he can be inspired with the faith so that he can come to the highest level. Okay? Yes. Just one. Praveen, can you get my water bottle? Yeah.
Yesterday's point of view, those who are cast into the darkest regions of hell, you were explaining about the Mayavadis properly. So, what is the scope for them to come to taste the sweetness of bhakti? Or they are like, many or some of them are just gone forever. How do they come?
Okay, let me think. What all do we have? After this, we have four verses. I think what we should be able to try to do is, in 2 hours, we should be able to complete 3 verses, if possible. And if we can do that, that's good. Otherwise, actually in the afternoon section, we can complete all 5 verses of the last section also. But we don't want to do that. What we'll try to do is, in 2 hours, or at least in the morning session, we'll try to complete 5 verses at least. That means this section we'll complete, and 1 or 2 verses the next section we'll take. Then we'll have 3 or 4 verses for the last session. So, okay, you want a break now, or after 2 hours, after 1 more hour? Huh? Okay, fine. Yes, bro.
I was asking how the Mayavadis will come to taste the sweetness of bhakti.
Yes. How will the Mayavadis come to taste? Generally speaking, it is through the association of devotees. Somehow they have to meet some Vaishnava who attracts them. Generally they think Vaishnavas are sentimental. I think in last years, or Vyas Puja of Radhanath Maharaj, Shukadeva Maharaj was telling that story of how he gave that book Journey Home to some Mayavadi. And that Mayavadi was initially very derisive of his con. But how now, after reading that book, he said, whenever we would meet, we would sit on the same chair. Now he sits at my feet. And he hears from me. So, it's very surprising how that happens. So the point is that, actually speaking, there are stories. I mean, not just... Tamal Krishna Maharaj had a very positive influence on many people when he was traveling in India and preaching, as well as in America. Because, you know, if a person has genuine spiritual advancement, even my impersonalists can see that. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when they saw him, Mayavadis also knew that he's an advanced person. Prakashananda Saraswati, when he saw that person fallen, not Prakashananda Saraswati, Sarvam Bhattacharya, when he saw this person fallen unconscious, he saw this person, he's a very advanced person. He's exhibiting very advanced symptoms of ecstasy. So, if they can meet a very spiritually advanced person, in general, there are 3 ways to influence people. One is through emotional charm or emotional appeal. Second is through intellectual conviction. And third is through spiritual potency. So when one has spiritual potency, one may also have the other two. But spiritual potency goes beyond. See, emotional appeal means some people can speak very sweetly, in a soft voice, they move their hands and legs and my face in such a way that people feel very charmed. Even if there's no intellectual substance in it. So one way, this is how personality cults are largely built. So emotional appeal. That's one way to influence people. Second is intellectual conviction. So argument, debate, and then they are convinced. Third is spiritual potency. So if you see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he dealt with both Prakashan Saraswati and Sarvabhaumacharya, actually, Prakashan Saraswati was, and Mayavadi is first attracted by spiritual potency. He manifested the Brahman effulgence. Then they said, what is this? And they became interested. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also, what he did was, actually in both cases, he made them do seva in some way. First Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went and sat down in the food washing place and they came and picked him up and brought him. So he made them do some seva. Similarly, Sarvabhaumacharya, he had that fatherly attitude, you know, I want to protect his sannyas. So although he was instructing, his mood was of service. So he let him do that service for 7 days. And then, he became open. So, basically, there was some expert dealing with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also. But overall, he influenced him by his spiritual potency. And then later on, he showed his intellectual prowess also. When he gave so much systematic explanation of the Vedanta Sutra. Yes, that actually, this explanation is better than Shankaracharya's. So that way, generally speaking, people who are very convinced about their path, probably the only way to influence them is by spiritual potency of a very advanced person.
Suji, in Prabhupada's case, did you find any such case where a hardcore Mayavadi, due to intellectual conviction or spiritual potency, turned into a devotee? Like Giriraj Maharaj and all were still kind of seekers.
So, did any hardcore Mayavadis convert into? Well, there's Siddha Swarup Ananda, who was earlier, I think, Prem Yogi. What is his name? He was Sai. Sai. He was already a guru with some disciples. The guru and disciples both became disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Well, he was sort of. See, anybody who is not connected with the Bhakti tradition has influence of Mayavad. It's like that. Before? At least that's what I've heard. Maybe I'll check it. That's one example. Another example that Sagar Prabhu is giving of Srinathji Prabhu. Srinathji Prabhu was following this spiritual leader who was quite a hardcore Mayavadi. And he was very skeptical of Srila Prabhupada. So Srinathji Prabhu is actually, you know, he's a very influential person and he's sort of sponsoring a author to write his biography. And that biography's theme is how an impersonalist became a devotee. So he's going to write everything. So first he took permission from Radhanath Maharaj because he'll have to speak some strong things about that particular spiritual teacher. So he's done that now. Radhanath Maharaj gave him permission. Then he was also involved in ISKCON history quite a bit. So he wrote to GBC also. GBC also gave permission for that book. So now it's going to come up soon. but he told me how it worked. It's very interesting. So he said that, you know, he would hear this Mayavadi lectures and come to Srila Prabhupada and ask questions. And Prabhupada would just smash all his questions. And then, whatever arguments he would give, he would go to that Mayavadi and ask. So it was going again and again between. So, Prabhupada told him, if he is God, let us see if he can stop himself from growing old. Can he make himself young and beautiful as he was in his youth? So he went back and said. So he said, yes, he's quite a blunt person. He went and asked like that to that Mayavadi. He says, actually, you know, I can reveal my potency to you, but first you have to show your surrender. You surrender to me, come inside my inner circle. Then I will show you. Then he said, again, he went and told him, Prabhupada said, this is just a bluff. And he said, okay, if he is God, can he show his Vishwarupa? So again, the same answer. Then Prabhupada told him that finally he said, okay, his hair are falling off. Can he at least stop the falling of his hair? So basically, like that, practically everything that he Prabhupada challenged, you know, show him, tell him to show that he is God. Can he show that? So all the proofs that he asked for, he said, later, later, later. And like that, it went on for quite a good amount of time. And Prabhupada also supplementing with Shastra. Your 13th chapter, Chitragam Chapi Mam Viddhi, and those verses. And finally, when he saw that this Guru was not ready to, Mayavadi teacher was not ready to give him any proofs, then he completely rejected him, came to Srila Prabhupada's feet. So it is, that is one good example. He was a, actually when he saw, when he came to India, Srila Prabhupada came to India, actually it was his father, Srinaji Prabhu's father, who was quite a religious person, and he was an MP also. So he hosted Prabhupada in his house. And he would host, but still Srinaji Prabhu was not very interested in going and meeting him. Because he thought his bhaktas are sentimental people. I am advanced Mayavadi. That was the idea. But then gradually he was converted. So he was, he's not a person who can be easily convinced. He's a skeptical person. And he was convinced by Srila Prabhupada. He said, I tried to find as much faults as I could. So he said, I just couldn't find faults. So that's a good example. In general, Srila Prabhupada's attitude was to not confront people who are committed to a particular path. Like there was one person who was committed to Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and then he became a devotee. And he told Prabhupada, I'm planning to go and meet Maharishi Mahesh Yogi because he was like an inside person, one of the inside followers. Yeah, I'm going to go and meet him. I'll try to convince him. Prabhupada said, don't waste your time. You know, he's too committed to his path, he's not going to change. People who are not yet so committed, go and try to persuade them. So in general, when people become committed to a path, then it's very difficult for them to change in this lifetime. But ultimately, of course there's this example of, who is that? In Hyderabad, Adbhut Gaurang Prabhu. Isn't Krishnamurti Prabhu? Advaita Gaurang Prabhu, he was a two decades or something, he was a follower of Mayavadi organization. More than 2 decades. And he had something like, you know, cupboards and cupboards full of Mayavadi books. And he had read so many books. So finally when he became a devotee, sometimes you have to ask questions to right persons. So he asked Jayadvaita Maharaj, Maharaj, what should I do with all those books? So Maharaj said, do Agni Samskar. Shocked. He said, at least you can do Jala Samskar, not Agni Samskar. So what he said is that if actually those books are Vedic books, for example, directly commented in the Bhagavad Gita, then you should not do Agni Samskar. But if the books are just what they have written, it's just their own thoughts, then you can do Agni Samskar. It's like that. But he's one person who is totally converted. I think he was more than 20 years connected with a Mayavadi, not just connected, committed to it. Yes, ma'am.
This much about the Lord which came. So, that time, Prabhuji, also bona fide Vaishnavas were there and Gaudiya Vaishnavism was there and all. So, like, how is that? These people independently studied and misconstrued scriptures or they also studied, like, what was the method of study? How the person couldn't come to right understanding? Or was it because it was all planned? Like, because to learn Sanskrit, he has to learn from some Vedic followers, right?
So why is it that Max Müller couldn't come in contact with Vaishnavas and get a correct understanding? Why did he get a wrong understanding? See, in general, because the Vedic culture is multi-level, so there are many people who are following Vedic culture. And often these people also had their own agendas. So, they were not really interested in knowing the true meaning of these books. They were interested primarily in proving the superiority of Christianity. In fact, some of these, if I can show you some of these quotes, they are quite shocking. So there are, Devamrita Maharaj has documented this in his book, Searching for Vedic India, and also in Elements of Vedic Thought. That is a book written by Satsurup Maharaj when Srila Prabhupada was still on the planet. At least he started the research at that time. Okay. This is a chapter. Visible? Mm-hmm. The chapter from the book. This is not, this book was earlier called as Elements of Vedic Thought. Now it is called as Readings in Vedic Literature. So, this is Baron Hastings, was the General of Governor General of India. The Hindu appears a being limited to mere animal functions, and even in them indifferent, with no higher intellect than a dog. So Alexander Duff started the Scots College in Calcutta. So headquarters for a great campaign against Hinduism. So historian Arthur Deans writes, the educators, these were the educators who educated Indians, had hardly concealed their expectation that with Western knowledge, the sacred fairy tales of the East would be dissolved, and the basis of popularly cherished creeds could be swept away. Thus he described the Bhagavad Purana as a motley story. Motley means just an arbitrary combination of strange things. So, here, who is this person? Mills. Now, Stuart Mills, his History of India is considered to be a classic. So, what does he say here? From the survey which has been submitted to you, you will perceive that the practical religion of the Hindus is by no means a concentrated and compact system, but a heterogeneous compound made up of various and not infinite. Anyway, I'll go on. What does he say? It is, however, of little avail yet to attempt to undeceive the multitude. Their superstition is based upon ignorance, and until the foundation is taken away, the superstructure, however crazy and rotten, will stay together. That is their idea. So they even had, what was the nature of the scholarship? He gave a series of, H.H. Wilson was the founder of the Bowdoin chair. So he would say, like you have some paper presentation in colleges. So he said, we'll give, help candidates for a prize of £200 for the best refutation of the Hindu religious system. So who can best refute it, he will get this prize. At that time, £200 was a huge amount. Devanath Maharaj writes that, this £200 was, at that time, more than the annual salary of a teacher. So for one paper, they were giving so much money. So their agenda was not really to know what is they're going to talk. So Max Müller wrote in 1976, India is much riper for Christianity than Rome or Greece were at the time of St. Paul. So I take part in a work by the means of which the old mischief of Indian priestcraft could be overthrown and the way opened for the entrance of simple Christian teaching. This is later on what he says. This is an example of fulfillment ideology. History seems to be think that the whole human race required gradual education before in the fullness of time it could be admitted through the truths of Christianity. So he's thinking this fulfillment. Of course, I think this is more restrained. So here, Monier Williams. So this one view was fulfillment. So Monier Williams is saying fulfillment is of no use. Now Monier Williams is the person who wrote a classic Sanskrit dictionary. Even today it is used. So he says fulfillment is of no use. You just have to use condemnation. There can be no doubt of a greater mistake than to force these non-Christian Bibles into conformity with some scientific theory of development and then point to Christians' Holy Bible as the crowning product of religious education. So far from this, these non-Christian Bibles are all developments in the wrong direction. they all begin with some flashes of true light and end in utter darkness. Anyway, this is a very provocative article, which actually their influence continues on even today in scholarship. So basically, that ultimately it's yethamam prapadyante. It's what drives one agenda, that's what one gets. Just like the Mayavadis, they study Vedic scriptures, but they come to a Mayavadi conclusion. So like that, these people, they study the Vedic literature, but they came to their own conclusion because that's what they wanted to come to. Okay. Yes. Yeah, okay, two questions we'll take, then we'll go to the next verse.
Puji, you were mentioning that the
11:15 already, my God. Okay.
Brahmic religions would not would claim that false God and the main God. Was it that revelation which they have written directly, or it's a concoction?
Okay, was it revelation about false gods and true gods? Ultimately, everything was given in these religions appeared in Hebrew. The original Old Testament comes in Hebrew. Hebrew is, it's quite difficult to translate into English. So, whether the original word was false or it was subordinate, that's a debatable issue from the original point of view. But as of now, they consider it false. So anyway, it can also be that there were many other people who were worshipping their own concocted gods. Just like now, there are people who are worshipping cricketers and sports and film stars and what else as gods. So, you know, in Calcutta, there are 6 temples of Kalyukaram. Who is Kalyukaram? Amitabh Bachchan. 6 temples of Amitabh Bachchan. They offer bhoga. They do aarti also. It's ridiculous. So, you know, at least from the Vedic point of view, what Muhammad did to idols over there, if somebody does to Amitabh Bachchan's idol, we have no problem. Isn't it? So this is idol worship, and this can be condemned. Should be condemned, actually. We're not condemning the person, but the idea that some person should be worshipped like this, that idea has to be condemned. So in that sense, there could have been false gods over also at that time.
Temples for human beings, means their gurus, something who taught them. So they build a temple for him also. They put the small demigods like left and right and something like Krishna on one side and Ganesh on one side, outside, there is a temple. So this is also should be condemned, right?
Okay, if the guru is right in the center, that is not proper. But not proper. But then we also have to see, according to time, place, circumstance. See, there's a difference between, say, a film star being worshipped and some spiritual personality being worshipped. Because the spiritual personality, like Swami Narayan, you know, they are quite pure and serious Vaishnavas. But the one thing that they consider Swami Narayan to be God. Now, if you put that as, you can say that is Mayavad. But, you know, they don't consider that we will become God. They don't consider that our Guru is God. The Guru doesn't claim I will become God. Only Swaminarayan is. They consider Swaminarayan to be an incarnation. And they say Swaminarayan taught Vaishnavism. And they also worship Krishna, they also worship Ram. But they also worship Swaminarayan. And they put Swaminarayan in the center of their temples. And they have all the avatars elsewhere. So we can say it is wrong. But overall, if you see their philosophy, you cannot call it Mayavad. Because they are not considering that everybody will become God or everybody is God. So it's not correct. But the point is that is something which is increasingly common in the Indian tradition. It's unfortunate that many times people consider their guru to be divine. Now, whether they consider him directly to be incarnation of God or empowered personality coming from God or whatever. But the point is we have to look at the overall teachings. So Swaminarayan and ISKCON have a fairly good relationship. And Swaminarayan also help ISKCON. And they come to ISKCON also to learn deity worship from us. Because they feel ISKCON has got very good deity worship. So apart from that one point, and you know, if you see, they also have very strict separation of men and women. In fact, in our first time in our temple, we have on the festivals in Pune, we have this barricade which separates men and women. So you know, that idea Rajashampuru got from Swaminarayan only. You know, he had gone to London, and there in that temple he saw it all like that. So when Lokanath Maharaj said, "Hey Radhesham, you're converting ISKCON into Swaminarayan now." So, but the point is that actually they are quite strict in all their practices. So that's why I said earlier, we have a very Mayavadi understanding of Mayavad. So these, I really don't think we can call them Mayavadis. So if they're accepting that Guru as God, it's unfortunate because their center of worship is shifting from Krishna to that Guru. But it's not Mayavad. Just accepting one particular Guru to be Mayavadi is not Mayavad. If Mayavad means, you know, all of us are God and all of us will become God. So we have to see according to time, place, circumstance, how it happens. So if some saint is being worshipped as God, that is certainly not the ideal recommended from the scriptures. But still, if only that saint is considered God, and along with that, actual God is also worshipped, and people are not thinking that I am going to become God, then that is not as bad as thinking that all of us are God, which is actually Mayavad. Ritviks are similar. Ritvikism, we have to see that more as a reaction to some of the problems that ISKCON faced. Some of our leaders had serious difficulties. And the Ritviks, of course, whatever they had, whatever be their claims to believe, they just felt that the current system of guru worship is wrong. And then they came up with this. So rather than attacking Ritvikism per se, we have to go at the root. So actually, if the traditional spiritual teachers, you know, in generation after generation, they keep becoming stronger through proper training and development of purity, then these sort of problems will not come. So Ritviks don't accept Prabhupada as God. They accept Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as God. But then they focus only on Prabhupada. And I don't think you can equate Ritviks to Swaminarayan again, because they are not replacing Krishna with Prabhupada. It's quite a strange deviation which has no precedent. The idea of saints being made into God, it is a total deviation in one sense, but it has many precedents. Ritvikism doesn't have any precedents as such.
In North, there are two famous people. One is Kabir and one is Tulsidas. And sometimes we refer them, sometimes we don't remember. So what is the correct understanding?
Okay. Kabir and Tulsidas. So both of them are exalted as very great saints, but there is a significant difference. Kabir was a hardline Mayavadi. But whatever respects are due for him, he has very strong Mayavadi means. What is that? Pathar puje to mile Ram, to mai to puju pahad. So he was completely against... So he had that sort of ideas. So that is... He might have been a renunciate or whatever you want. He might have been a transcendentalist, but he was a hardline Mayavadi. Tulsidas, as far as he is concerned, he was a proper Vaishnava. Actually, the North India, the Ramanandi Sampradaya is a part of the Ramanandi Sampradaya. That might have been influenced by little Mayavad here and there. But Tulsidas Ramayan has actually kept generations and generations of Rama Bhakti alive in North India. And now, if you see Prabhupada's position on Tulsidas, it is somewhat ambiguous. One devotee wrote a letter to Prabhupada asking, can I read Ramcharitmanas? And Prabhupada said, there's no need, Valmiki Ramayana is authentic. And he said that something like, he basically discouraged him from reading Tulsi Ramayana. But if you see paradoxically, Prabhupada quotes Tulsi Ramayana in the Bhagavatam purports also. That famous Din ki daki ni raag ki baki, that is from Tulsidas. Now Prabhupada quotes him, and Prabhupada also had one place is condemned. There is a famous poet who also believes that caste is by birth or something like that. Prabhupada one place quotes him negatively also. So in general, if you look, Prabhupada is quoting, this is not just one, there are several other places also where Prabhupada quotes him. So overall, some devotees try to say that this Tulsi Ramayana is deviant and it is Mayavadi and things like that. And when Prabhupada's god brothers, like Puri Maharaj and Sridhar Maharaj heard this, they were very angry. They said, I think Puri Maharaj, he said, I grew up throughout my childhood reading Tulsi Ramayana. And actually speaking, if we see, the bhakti is much stronger in Tulsi Ramayana than Valmiki Ramayana. Because Valmiki Ramayana is written with the focus of revealing Ram as the ideal human being. Valmiki Ramayana starts with the question, Valmiki is asking Lord Narad Muni, who is the ideal human being? Who has all good qualities, who has knowledge, who has virtue, who has strength, who has self-control, all those things. So then In the Valmiki Ramayana, practically there is no section where devotees are offering prayers to Lord Ram. The affection to Lord Ram of everyone is obvious. But the devotional offering of prayer, that's not there practically anywhere. So the bhakti feelings are seen only in the later literature. And Tulsi Ramayana, as far as you can see, the bhakti is very strong in it. Very intense. And in general, nowadays, more and more ISKCON devotees are quoting. Radha Govind Maharaj regularly quotes from it. And several other devotees. Gaur Govind Maharaj asked this question. Recently, Krishna Kathamrita Bindu comes by from Madhavanand Prabhu. He's a respected Vaishnava. So, recently before Ram Navami, in one of his issues, he had quoted a verse from Ramcharitmanas. So, I wrote to him and asked him, what is your position? So, he said, my spiritual master Gaur Govind Maharaj had quoted this. And when he was asked this question, that there is a Mayavadi taint in it. So, he said, where are the Mayavadi taints? Show me. He asked all his disciples. I read this several times. I don't find any Mayavadi anywhere. If you find it, tell me. Then we'll discuss. So he was quite forthright about defending Tulsi Ramayana. So what I would say is that Srila Prabhupada's letters don't have the authority of the purports. They have authority, but not of the purports. And we should not use one letter to reject what is a substantial part of the bhakti tradition. This is not Mayavadi tradition, bhakti tradition. Actually, every year they have this, what do you call it, the Ram festival they have, where almost 30 days, full Ram Lila is performed in Ramnagar near Varanasi. And thousands of people come there and they participate in very intensely devotional event. And it's entirely based on Tulsi Ramayana. So if we have a very narrow understanding of what is Shastra, we will cut ourselves off a large part of the greater bhakti tradition to which we belong. In fact, if you want to go that way, then actually speaking, that famous story of the gopis offering their dust to Krishna when Krishna has a headache, that is not there in any of the scriptures. It is not there in the Bhagavatam, obviously. It is not there in Padma Purana, it is not there in Vishnu Purana, it is not there in Gopal Champu, it is not there in Anandavan Champu. It's not there in what is the other book? Garga Samhita, it is not there. It is not there. But then, it illustrates the love of the gopis, selflessness of the love of the gopis, better than any other story. So, in Rupa Goswami, in Bhakti Samhita Sindhu says that there are two kinds of pramanas. There is Shastra Pramana and there is Lok Pramana. So, Krishna, talking to Uddhava in the Uddhava Gita, says, calls this same as Aitihya. Shutiha pratiksha maitiham, anumanesha chatushtayam, pramanesha anuvasthana, vikalpatsa virajit. Aitiha is itihas, historical records. So, if you see many times when you go to yatras, so Dinabandhu may tell some story. People say over here that Radharani came here. That story may not be in Puranas. So, in general, if a story is... So, Valmiki Ramayana is the original Ramayana that has the highest authority. If a story does not contradict either the storyline of Valmiki Ramayana and does not contradict the philosophy of Valmiki Ramayana, then it is a part of the larger Rama tradition and you can accept it. The same principle we apply to the Krishna tradition also. So the tradition is much broader than one scripture, because the scripture is like the nucleus, but around the nucleus so much else is there. No scripture can comprehensively document the Lord's pastimes. Because the Lord's pastimes are infinite, practically speaking. So, Tulsi Ramayana should not be condemned. Because it will alienate us from a large number of people and we ourselves might be on unstable grounds. Because even if we read it, it's unlikely that we can find any Mayavadi verses. Okay, I think we should move forward now. Okay, so anybody can write a pastime, it can be utilized. Fine. That possibility is always there. But Loka Praman in itself does not mean anything and everything can be accepted. So there is the boundary of the Siddhanta. If anything goes against Siddhanta, that cannot be accepted. And if anything goes explicitly against the storyline, like there is one version of Ramayana which says that just before this exile of Lord Ram, Kaikeyi was, Lord Ram approached Kaikeyi and told her, if you love me, can you do one service for me? He said, what is that? I'll do anything for you. He says, if you do this service, you will be misunderstood for all of history. Will you still do it for me? He says, I love you, I'll do it. If you do this, because of the service, your husband may also die. Will you still do it for me? He says, things are loaded. Yes, I'll do it for you. Please tell me, what is it? And she tells, go and ask your Dashrath Maharaj to exile me for 14 years and to have Bharat made as the king. So now what this interpretation tries to portray is Kaikeyi is also such a great devotee. Now, okay, at one level we can say everybody in Lord's pastime is special. But you know, if this storyline is accepted, then the whole point of mantra poisoning Kaikeyi becomes redundant. Now then if Lord Raman told her, where is the question of mantra poisoning her? Then you will have to have Lord Ram going to mantra to tell her that. Isn't it? So this sort of thing is directly contradicting the storyline. So now, in the Valmiki Ramayana, Shabari offering, receiving and serving Lord Ram is given. But offering her Jhuta fruits is not given. But that illustrates the principle of bhakti beautifully. That's not wrong. So the principle is that there is a tradition. See, again, we have to understand, scripture is not a closed book. Scripture is a living tradition. Scripture is not a closed book. It is a living tradition. And just as the Bhagavatam expands, we have Lord Krishna giving only 4 verses to Brahmaji. But Shukdev Goswami is giving us 18,000 verses. So scripture is not a closed book. It is a living tradition. And now, the possibility is there that somebody can spin his own imagination and come up with some tales. But there is also the possibility that there may be great saints to whom pastimes may be revealed which were not revealed originally in the first book that was written. So now how do we know which is the actual story? We have to use Guru Sadhu, which is the actual story and which is the concocted story. It is Guru Sadhu Shastra. So, if we look at it and see that it's not incompatible with Shastra's teaching and Shastra's storyline, and if our Acharyas have accepted it, then we can accept it. So this story of gopis is accepted by our Acharyas. So of course, one thing that happens is that to some extent, we have a very narrow and stereotype understanding of what a tradition is. We think tradition is just one line coming down. One line coming down from the past to modern. It's not exactly a line. For example, now is somebody following Srila Prabhupada or not following Srila Prabhupada? But Srila Prabhupada himself did so many different things at different times. So tradition is not just one line. Tradition is more like a circle. It's more like a circle. And within that circle, different current leaders may position themselves at different positions. So some of the current generation leaders, they may focus more on temple construction. Some may focus on devotee cultivation. Some may focus on, say, youth preaching. Some may focus on book distribution. So, are all of them following Srila Prabhupada? Yes. So, how it is? It's not just tradition. It's not just one line that is coming down. It is a circle. So, rather than asking whether somebody is following Srila Prabhupada's instructions, well, we should follow Prabhupada's basic instruction following 4 realms and 16 rounds. But beyond that, if some leader comes up with some new project, and we have to see whether that is compatible with the overall mood and mission of Srila Prabhupada. Even if Srila Prabhupada specifically might not have done that, but is it compatible with the overall mood and mission of Srila Prabhupada? If it is, that's fine. So Bhaktivedanta Maharaj is one of the most successful preachers, but he used to wear so many different kinds of dresses and he has so many different names. In fact, in Gitanagari, they have made a museum of all the dresses that he used to wear. You know, a small museum, but it's just that he used all that. It was Yukta Vairagya. And he did that, and he was successful. He attracted so many people to Krishna, if not to Krishna, lotus feet, to become devotees, which large number did also. But more than that, he created Agyat Sukriti for a large number of people. So tradition is not a frozen book. It is actually a living principle. And it may keep expanding generation after generation. Okay? Can afterwards. Well, the question may be short, the answer may not be short. In general, see, I would say that it depends on the person's commitment. If the person is committed, we can encourage him to read Valmiki Ramayana. If the person is not yet committed, don't hurt him by telling him don't read Valmiki Ramcharitmanas. Let him read it. And it's not wrong also. And he can read it. Generally, personally, if somebody quotes Valmiki Tulsi Ramayana, I will not go on a campaign against that person, saying that should not be quoted. Like I told yesterday that somebody was saying St. Francis of Assisi, St. Xavier is a saint, I went on a campaign against it. And I got the book stopped from being published. I won't do anything like that. I don't think this deserves it. If somebody quotes it, fine. Doesn't matter. They can read it. They should not do it as a substitute for Prabhupada books. As a supplement to Prabhupada books, they can read it. Okay. So, we just finished. It's already 2 hours, I think. So, we just finished one part of one verse. So, I think we are a little behind track. We'll have a 10 minutes break and we'll continue after that. Thank you. So after looking at demigod worship, so the question may be that andham tamah pravishanti ye sambhut upasate. So how can we say that the demigod worshippers stay in darkness? Prabhupada explained that the whole material world is dark. And the demigod worshippers stay in the dark material world. In that sense, they stay in the darkness of material existence. And the tobhuya ivate tamaha. So now let's come to So this is Mayavad. So Mayavad is a khichdi. Khichdi has four things. Isn't it? So it is based on Upanishads. Khichdi is made of one thing. The grains of impersonalism come from the Upanishads. But then, it is taken, added the sugar of social service from Christianity, the spice of nationalism from the Indian national movement, Indian independence movement, and the envy of Krishna from the hearts of the conditioned souls. So, Mayavad. So in this sense, what is originated in the Upanishads is Brahmavad. But all these things when I added to Brahmavad, then it becomes Mayavad. Now, I am talking here primarily about modern Mayavad. The traditional Mayavad, Advaita Vad, which was taught by Shankaracharya, that was quite different. That was surely much more world-rejecting than modern Mayavad is. So why sugar and spice? Sugar is very sweet to taste. So social service appears very appealing to most people. And in fact, for most people, what happened was, over a period of time, as Christianity's theological beliefs were questioned and contradicted by science, like the idea that the earth is at the center of the universe, or that the earth is 6,000 years old, or things like that, as they are progressively contradicted, Christianity went on more and more on defensive. So Christianity started justifying its existence by talking about how Christianity has helped make the world a better place. And this is called as ethical religion. Religion makes people more ethical. It contributed ethically. And one of the contributions was social service. So, to some extent they adopted this also. So, okay, Hindu beliefs might have many lot of irrational things in it. But see, Hindus are making the world a better place. So, that's how they adopted social service from there. And then nationalism, as I told earlier, how nationalism came into it. And envy of Krishna is what? Ultimately, why should Krishna be the enjoyer? It is I who will be the enjoyer. So Prabhupada gives the logic of Mayavad. Is Krishna is Brahma, I am Brahma, so I am Krishna. So it's like Prabhupada says that I am an Indian, the Prime Minister is an Indian, therefore I am the Prime Minister. So it is so simplistic as to be absurd. But that is their logic. So that actually expresses envy for Krishna. So where is the envy here? The envy is that I want to enjoy material existence. But I find I can't enjoy it. Because sense happiness is so temporary, so little. Then we find, we go to Krishna Lila, we find Krishna is enjoying with the gopis. Krishna is enjoying. So what he says, if I can't be the enjoyer, then there is no enjoyment and there is no enjoyer only. Ultimately, there is only existence. So Krishna's enjoyment is also a product of illusion. And ultimately, one has to go beyond all enjoyment. So basically, Mayavad, out of frustration that we can't be the enjoyer, claimed that even Krishna can't be the enjoyer. So in that sense, it is the envy of Krishna. So, regarding the history of Mayavad, we have discussed most of this. I'll quickly summarize this, and we won't have any question answers on this. So, Upanishads, as we know, is a transitional or stepping stone plan they have, from Karmakanda to Bhakti. So, first, come in the house of religion, and then move forward and accept that there is, your sense relativity is bad, so go beyond that. So, they're transitional. You remember the negative axis? Neutral and positive axis. They are stepping stones in the Vedic master plan. So where impersonalists are right and where they go wrong. Where they are right is an understanding that the forms and the pleasures of this world are false. So the first part, what are the material forms and varieties lead to material desires, and material desires lead to material miseries. This is the part where they are right. They are right over there. But from this right conclusion, they make the wrong extrapolation. See, conclusion means what is right. But from that you extend it further beyond its valid jurisdiction. That they say all forms, all varieties are in the realm of illusion. So this they call as vyavaharik. That they have two levels of reality, the technical word they use is vyavaharik and paramarthik. You say in the paramarthik, only Brahman is the reality. In Vyavaharik, all forms are there, including Krishna's form also. So material forms are the cause of misery, that is a valid point. But that all forms are a cause of misery, all forms are a product of illusion, that is an invalid extrapolation. So we discuss about how in medieval times, medieval means the middle century, say 5th to 15th century. That time how Mayavad spread to refute Buddhism. And modern times how it spread? It spread to counter Christianity and to boost nationalism. So it became quite twisted because of that. Where Mayavadi is existing before Shankaracharya? Impersonalism was existing because that's there in the Upanishads directly. Shankaracharya had a guru whose name was Gaudapada. He had also written, I think his favorite book was Mandukya Upanishad. He wrote a commentary on that, which also had some Mayavadi taints in it. Now, ultimately, Mayavad is a name. It's a school of thought. So what Shankaracharya did was, the idea that I can be God or I am God, it is the root or root disease because its soul has come to material existence. So that, in one sense, is always there. Not just in before Shankaracharya, but throughout conditioned souls have that desire. But what Shankaracharya did was, tried to prove that it is the conclusion of the Vedic literature. The idea that I am God is there. So it's like Vedic literature are here and Mayavad is here. Just like Vedic literature is here, atheism is here. Atheism is its own philosophy. But if somebody tries to prove that the Vedic literature teach atheism, that is what is objectionable. So like that, Mayavad might have been in existence, and it's quite logical because that's the root disease of material existence. It will be in existence. But what Shankaracharya did was, tried to prove that Mayavad is a teaching of the Vedic literature. So in that sense, so when that interpretation is given that way, so actually the word Mayavad is used for that particular point. So in that we can say that Mayavad might have been existing earlier, but it was purported to be based on the Vedic literature by Shankaracharya, and it was aggressively propagated by Shankaracharya. So then, what are the disasters caused by Mayavad? I have shown it here. gave once this Bhagavatam in Pune where I talk about 12 disasters caused by Mayavad. Here I'll talk only about 2 disasters. So, first is that the soul thinks I am spiritual, but he's deprived of the taste of bhakti. Because he really says, bhakti is lower, I have to go beyond bhakti. So first, the soul who is actually a spiritual seeker is deprived of the taste of bhakti. And secondly, what happens is once the soul is deprived of the taste of bhakti, the soul needs happiness somewhere. So the soul comes back to material life. And so material life, which is with its variety and activity, appears more attractive than spiritual life. So many Mayavadis actually encourage people to become materialists, directly and indirectly. Directly means they may say statements like one football ground is better than 100 Bhagavad Gitas. They may directly encourage materialism. And indirectly, they may say that actually the formless absolute is a very, very advanced stage and you can't realize it quickly. So till then you have to stay in the material realm, do your work well over here. Which is not wrong in and of itself. But what happens is, at least in principle, people need to understand that spiritual life is better than material life. Spiritual life is superior to material life. And that is where my desire should be. But that doesn't happen often by my own. At least in practical sense, material life appears much more attractive than spiritual life. And these are not small things. Prabhupada writes in the purport of this verse that my impersonalists indirectly help the atheists. The atheists deny the existence of God. And the impersonalist, for all practical purposes, make God non-existent by saying that he's impersonal. He just becomes an abstract conception. And all of us know the story of that parrot, isn't it? All of you know the story of the king's parrot? The king had given a parrot to his minister to take care of and told him, take care of it nicely, never report to me that the parrot has died. So when did the parrot actually died? So then the king's minister thought, what to do now? So when he came to the king, king asked, how is the parrot? Parrot is okay. It's just one problem. What? It doesn't eat any food. Oh. Any other problem? Yeah, just one more problem. It doesn't sing. Oh, is it? Okay. Any other problem? Yeah. Just one more. It doesn't move anymore. Oh, is it? That's all. Any other problem? Yeah, he's just lying motionless and he seems to be rotting. That means he's dead. I won't say that. If I say that, then you will kill me. So I didn't say that. The king had made the condition, if you ever give me the news that parrot has died, I'll kill you. So Mayavadis will never say that God doesn't exist. I never said God didn't exist. But, you know, God doesn't have eyes, God doesn't have hands, God doesn't have legs, God doesn't have form, God doesn't have personality. God doesn't, then what does God have? See, if you look at language itself, you say, this is Krishna, this is the absolute truth. No, the absolute truth is just a light. See, just is a word that we use to minimize something, you know. He's just a fool. So, God, absolute truth is just a light. What isn't that a minimization? So actually, speaking Mayavadi will never say that God doesn't exist. But for all practical purposes, those who follow Mayavad, for them God doesn't exist. Because God just becomes an abstract conception with no tangible reality. Therefore, material life becomes more attractive than spiritual life. So let's go to the next verse now.
Anya devahu sambhavad, anya dahura sambhavad. Iti shushrumadhiranam yenastad vichuchakshire.
It is said that one result is obtained by worshipping the supreme cause of all causes and that another result is obtained by worshipping what is not supreme. All this is heard from the undisturbed authorities who clearly explained it.
So this purport, Srila Prabhupada continues to some extent what was discussed in the earlier purport. So the earlier purport we discussed about flexibility of sadhya, the goal. Now this purport focuses flexibility of sadhana. So there is flexibility of sadhana, but still there is also ultimacy of one particular sadhana. One sadhana is the highest. Srila Prabhupada focuses on the point that all paths do not lead to the same goal. So, Prabhupada says how Dhira teaches that different paths lead to different goals. And what is the standard verse in the Bhagavad Gita which says this? Yeah, very clear. Yanti 9.25. Yanti Deva Pratadevan. Clearly. And we know this verse actually refers to the three modes and transcendence. Devavrata Devan is demigod. Pitranyanti Pitruja. Sorry. Devavrata, that is goodness. Pitra worship is passion. Bhuta worship is ignorance. And Krishna worship is transcendental. It's very clear. Krishna is telling in the different paths lead to different goals. So first of all, there is no scriptural basis to the idea. So we will look at it. This idea that all paths lead to the same goal. We will look at it in three ways. Logical, scriptural, grammatical. So grammatical means we will look at which verses from the scripture seem to say that all paths lead to the same goal. And what is their actual understanding. So first scriptural, we look at the opposing verses. There are many verses actually. 9.25 is the most prominent. But Srila Prabhupada gives a simple principle. One person asks him in an American university, Swamiji, I don't know which verse, but in the Bhagavad Gita it says that whatever you do, you will ultimately come back to me, Krishna says. Then Prabhupada says, if whatever you do, you are going to come back to Krishna, then why does Krishna have to speak the Bhagavad Gita? Whatever you do, you will come back to him. The very fact that Krishna speaks the Bhagavad Gita, he clearly says, do this, don't do this. So actually, if we look at this contrast verses, contrast verses means Krishna gives two verses. If you do this, you will get this. If you do this, you will get this. Krishna uses this tool of contrast repeatedly in the Bhagavad Gita. Practically in every chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, this contrast is there. If you look at it, 2.69. Yanisha sarvabhutana tasyam jagrati sanyami. Then we have 3.31-32. Just check it. 3.31. Yetvet yeme matamidam nityam anutishtanti manava shraddhavanto anusinto ucchante tepi karmabhi. 31. The next one is yetvet adabhyasanto nantishtanti mema matam. So 3.31-32. Then there is 4.39-40. Where again Krishna talks about faith. He says agyascha shraddhadhanascha shraddhavallabhate jnanam. If you do this, you will get this. If you do this, you will get this. So Krishna is giving a contrast like that many places. And I'll take a lot of time. I can tell on every chapter. Yes, and the most prominent one. Because 16 chapter, the whole chapter itself is divine and demoniac natures. It's very clear. So 16.23-24. 23 says is that you by divine demoniac go down to hell, divine get elevated. And again there is, I think, 16.18, urdhvam gacchin satata madhya tishtanti rajasa jaganya guna uttista adho gacchin namasa. There are so many verses like that in the Gita. And lastly, the most clear is 18.58. 18.58 is machitta sarvadurgani matprasadat tarishyasi atachetvam ahankaran nashroshyasi vinangshasi. So if you want to go on the scriptural level, there are so many verses Krishna says, you do this, you will get this, you do this, you will get this. And at a broad level, Krishna is dividing into two parts, material life and spiritual life. But even within spiritual life, also he is giving a hierarchy. If you do this, you will get this. If you do this, you will get this. So most of these contrasts which I gave here are for material life and spiritual life. So at least at that level, Krishna doesn't say all paths lead to the same goal. Material life leads to a very different destination. Spiritual life leads to a very clearly different destination. And as far as the various spiritual paths are concerned, Krishna very clearly establishes that among all the spiritual paths, bhakti is the highest. So if you look at the path of yoga, we have 6.46-47. Tapasvibhyo adhiko yogi and yoginam api sarvesha. So this is actually talking about yoga to bhakti. Or rather, let us put it like this. Ashtang yoga to bhakti yoga. 6.46-47 Ashtanga Yoga to Bhakti Yoga. Then we have 7.6 Jnana Yoga to Bhakti Yoga. So 7.16 Krishna talks about Chaturvidha Vajante Maam, four kind of people surrender unto me. And 7.19 he says, Bahunam Janmanante Jnanavan Maam Prapadyate, 7.16 to 19. And similarly, he talks about how different the karma yogi is superior to karmi, but then he says the culmination of karma yoga is mai sarvani karmani sanyasya adhyatma chetasa nirashi nirmo bhuta yuddhasya yugata jvara. And 18th chapter of this progression comes several times again. The point is Krishna talks about a progression, and the progression bhakti is at the highest. And if there is any further doubt, there is Krishna is making it very clear. Krishna is not saying all paths lead to me. Give up all other paths, he says. Just take up my path. Sarvadharman paritaja mam ekam sharanam vraja. So therefore, from the scriptural point of view, at least as far as Bhagavad Gita is concerned, there is no basis to the idea that all paths lead to the same goal. So, now if we come to the logical point, what is the logical example that Srila Prabhupada gives about how all paths cannot lead to the same goal? Ticket. Okay. If I sit in a train that is going to Calcutta, I will not get to go to Chennai. Or I will not come to Mumbai. Now, does anyone know what is the refutation of Mayavadis to this? Yeah, but they don't put it like that. They put it in a very deceptive way. See, do you think that God is a limited place like Mumbai or Calcutta? God is unlimited. God is unlimited. Therefore, you are giving a wrong example. So, imagine if God is everywhere, then wherever you go, you will come to God. So Prabhupada answers the Chaitanya Charitamrita purport. Very brilliant answer, he says. Mayavadi says, Sarvam Khalvamidam Brahma. Everything is Brahma. So, he says, some Mayavadis say that actually the taste of the holy name is Brahma, the taste of sex is Brahma, the taste of liquor is also Brahma. Well, everything is Brahma. So, but Prabhupada says that ultimately whatever pleasure we get, it's Brahma. It's fine. But the important point is, ultimately Dharma Virudha Bhuteshu Kamasu, Krishna says. He says, I am the taste of water. So you can extend it and say, I am the taste of liquor also. And Prabhupada does say that. If a drunkard can think of Krishna while drinking liquor, he will one day become a devotee. But the point is, it's not whether a particular thing is Brahma or not. It is whether that helps us to realize Brahman. See, all these are separated, fragmented manifestations of Brahman. So even the beauty of a Bollywood star is also a manifestation of Krishna's beauty. But does that beauty take us closer to Krishna? Does that beauty bring us closer to remembrance of the beauty of Krishna? Generally, it does it. So, we can say that the absolute truth is everywhere and everything. But, that is only one manifestation of the absolute truth. The Brahman is everywhere. And wherever, if we just say that the absolute truth is everywhere and in everything, then there is no need for the classification of goodness, passion and ignorance. But the Bhagavad Gita, not just the Bhagavad Gita, all the Vedic literature gives the classification of goodness, passion and ignorance. And our point is not whether absolute truth is everywhere or not. See, the analogy is not about the nature of the absolute truth. The analogy is about the approach, the path through the absolute truth. There's a difference. What is happening here is, whenever we give analogy, if you're not clear about what we are specifying, this analogy is not to illustrate the nature of the absolute truth. It is to illustrate the path through the absolute truth. And it is very clear to any person with the basic intelligence that, you know, if a person lives morally and if a person lives immorally, there is a difference in lifestyle and there is a difference in consequences. So obviously, from a common sense point of view, not all forms of behavior will take us closer to God. So we are talking about which behavior and which lifestyle will take us closer to God. And as far as logic is concerned, we can ourselves see with common experience that there are certain activities are godly and certain activities are ungodly. Now some people may say everything is in the mind, but it's not everything in the mind, because things have their objective effects on our consciousness. You know, when we indulge in sense gratifying, simple point is, if you just eat a heavy feast and then sit down to study Srimad Bhagavatam, what happens? You may say everything is in the mind, but there is something in the stomach also. And that has its effect. So, it's not that everything is in the mind. Even gross material things and subtle material things have a real effect on the consciousness. So therefore, if you look at the logic, God may be everywhere, but we cannot realize His presence equally everywhere. We cannot realize His presence equally everywhere. When a person has sex, he is not really thinking about God at all. When a person is chanting Hare Krishna, he is at least trying to think about God. And when a person is in ecstasy in remembrance of Krishna, he is completely absorbed in God. We can say, on one continuum, all of these pleasures are manifesting the pleasure of Brahman only. Yad yad vibhuti mat sattvam, Krishna says. All pleasures, everything beautiful comes from me. But everything beautiful may come from Krishna, but everything beautiful doesn't take us to Krishna. Everything pleasurable may come from Krishna, but everything pleasurable doesn't take us to Krishna. So, there is a clear difference between the modes of passion, ignorance and goodness, and then transcendence. And what takes us to Krishna is goodness and then transcendence. That's why the idea that all paths lead to the same goal is logically also invalid. Now, as far as... Yeah? Okay, then at least for that time, except that all paths don't lead to same goal. That means at least at that level, all paths don't lead to same goal. You have to accept that. So, in the Vyavaharic mode at least, one has to accept that there is a philosophy. All paths will not lead to the same goal. As a moral Mayavad is riddled with contradictions. It's riddled completely with contradictions. Anyway, so the point is, now let's come to the so logically we discuss grammatically there's only one verse in the Bhagavad Gita which can be misinterpreted to support this. That is the second part of Yathamam Prapadyate. 4.11, second part. Prabhupada would quote the first part is the reciprocity principle. Yathamam Prapadyate Namsadhe Vajamya. As all people surrender to me, I reward them accordingly. Bhayavadi like to quote the second part. Mama Vartamanu Vartante Manushyah Partha Sarvashah. Mama Vartamanu Vartante. All paths lead to me. This is their translation. But if you look at it, Mama Vartamanu Vartante Manushyah Partha Sarvashah. So Sarvashah is an adjective. Now, normally an adjective qualifies a noun. So an adjective, so if, for example, beautiful building. So beautiful is the adjective which is qualifying a noun, building. So according to the grammatical rules of any language, including Sanskrit, adjective qualifies the nearest noun. So if you look at Mama Vartamanu Vartante Manushyah Partha Sarvashah. So Sarvashah, it is closer to what? Manushyah, not to Vartma. Vartma means paths. So what Mayavadi says, all paths lead to me. Mama Vartma Sarvashah. That's how they bring it up. But actually, there is a big noun before that, that is Manushyah. So all people are on the path to me, which is true. All people follow my path. That's how Srila Prabhupada translates it. That ultimately there is people are coming towards Krishna, people are going away from Krishna. So in that sense, all people are on my path. But when they are attracted to anything in this world, they are attracted to manifesting of Krishna. In that sense, they are on my path. But it's not that all paths ultimately lead to me only necessarily. Prabhupada says that ultimately one has to develop the consciousness. Prabhupada gives another simple example. He says, okay, all paths lead to the same goal. Fine, Prabhupada, agreed. Tell us, what is the same goal? Oh, same goal? That's what you think about. Then how is it same? Isn't it? If the goal is whatever I think about and you think about, then it is not the same goal. Then all paths don't lead to the same goal. So let us agree at least about what is the same goal. As soon as you take this idea, what is the same goal, then they will find there is no sameness, there is a lot of difference in the goals also. So actually it's not sustainable. It's a simplistic way of trying to do away with serious differences. So Prabhupada talks about this in two ways here. That if we accept Krishna as the absolute truth, then one has to surrender. And he gives the example of how Arjuna surrenders. Prabhupada says, Krishna, he kills the so-called relatives. Why? Because at the level of soul, there are no relatives. That's why he uses the word so-called relatives. It's for the sake of Krishna. And then, if we don't accept Krishna as the absolute truth, then we come up with many misconceptions. Two of them are, that I am God, or people are my God. So Prabhupada is referring to a politician at that time, you know, who was trying to go against the Congress, which was in power. And he said, Janta hi meri Bhagwan hai. Talia, talia, talia. People are so happy. Ah, we are all God. So he said, the public is my God. That was the idea that this particular politician had. Prabhupada was so angry with it. How can you say people are God? So, these sort of conceptions come up because people are just using the concept of God in a very utilitarian way. Okay. Regarding Shirdi Sai Baba, it seems that he was basically some sort of spiritual person. But the whole cult of worship of him as God developed after him. And it all happened primarily through Bollywood. I mean, there were some film stars, they attracted to him and they made movies out of him. And then thousands of people started worshipping him. It was mainly through movies. Like, at least Shirdi Sai Baba was a historical person and movies made into him into God. But Santoshi Ma was not even a historical person. You know, she was just a fictional character. And that was also not from the fiction of a spirit of some saint. It was a fiction of a script writer for Bollywood. And from his fiction, a goddess was born. And so many people are worshipping her. You know, these are the kind of things which make people very skeptical. Intelligent people become skeptical. You people are so foolish. Some entity who is not existing, only you are worshipping that person as God. That is ridiculous. So now, Srila Prabhupada says, towards the end, Adi purport that actually when we hear from the Dhira, then when one and all can attain perfection. And who is that Dhira? The Dhira is not a politician. A Dhira is a guru in parampara. Only through him when we hear, we can learn properly. Otherwise, one keeps getting entangled in material existence. So, I am not going into reading all the purport as we know. I will not go into much details of the purport also. But this is the broad outline. Any questions on this? Should we move ahead? Okay. Let's move forward. So now, hey, what happened? Okay, correct. So now, Sambhutim cha vinasham cha Yastad Vedo Bhayam Saha Vinashen Mrityun Tirtva Sambhutya Mritam Ashnute. Translation?
With its temporary demigods, men and animals, when one knows these, he surpasses death and the ephemeral cosmic manifestation with it. And in the eternal kingdom of God, he enjoys his eternal life of bliss and knowledge.
So again, we come here to the concept of immortality. And here Srila Prabhupada is a very interesting point that the six laws of material transformation, this is any material object in this world, even if it is having life, it will go through these six changes. So what is that? We know all these changes. But Prabhupada calls them as the six laws of transformation. So everything that is created. Now if you see, at a material level, is there any difference between living and non-living things? This is the difference. This mic stand, it is created, it will deteriorate, it will get destroyed. But our body, we could call it we call it as living body. Scientists call it as living matter. Actually, matter is not living. But whenever there's life in matter, so we can call it non-living things and living beings. So living beings always go through the six transformations. There is, after creation, there is growth. And when this mic is created, it does not grow, isn't it? And then there is maintenance. If I have a computer, the computer glass gets cut, gets cracked, it doesn't repair by itself. If my skin gets cut, there's a clotting by which it will repair. So there's a tendency to maintain itself. And then there is reproduction. All living beings, they reproduce. It may be sexually or asexually, but they reproduce. So when they reproduce, they actually give light to new forms. Now, no matter how sophisticated a robo may be, a he robo and she robo cannot produce a baby robo. That just doesn't happen. And then there's deterioration, there's destruction. So now here one point about asexual reproduction. Srila Prabhupada often gives the example of how can, when we say nature, who's nature? Isn't it? And he says, how can, nature is like the mother, how can the mother produce without the father? So that is the general rule. Somebody may argue that there's asexual reproduction, where there is no mother and father, there's just one living being which reproduces. You know this asexual reproduction, you must have studied biology. And there's only one sex, and that itself reproduces. So generally how it works is, if the soul abuses the sexual propensity too much, and the soul is put in a body where it does not have the sexual capacity only. So that asexual reproduction is a deviation from the norm of material existence. Srila Prabhupada is giving an example based on a standard practice in material existence. And there might be some things in material, as I said, no material analogy is perfect. So there might be some problems in some analogies. But in general, living beings reproduce. It may be sexually or asexually. Somebody may say, a fire is non-living, but fire also grows. Isn't it? If one places it fire, it can move from that cupboard to this cupboard, and it can come to this table. Fire grows. But that growth is not like the growth of biological cells. That growth is a simple spreading. That's just like water may spread. I put water over here, water spreads. So actually when we talk about growth, it is biological cell reproduction which involves an elaborate process. So now non-living matter grows like that. Now, scientists try to find out this last part. So Prabhupada says nobody can stop these six changes, therefore nobody can become immortal. Now, scientists are trying to find out what actually causes death. So now, from the general point of view, they know that the cells in the body are dying and are getting reproduced. And they find that as a organism grows to a particular age, then somehow the rate of regeneration becomes lesser than the rate of degeneration. Regeneration means new cells being created. Degeneration means old cells being destroyed. That means the number of cells which are destroyed becomes greater than the number of cells which are created. And as this becomes more and more, the organism starts aging and then it dies. So then they started investigating to find out what causes this decrease in the rate of regeneration, the rate of production of new cells. Then the current fashion is, just like earlier, scientists were ascribing everything to chance. How did this come out? By chance. The current fashion is to ascribe everything to genes. Genes are the new god of science. Everything that happens, it's all due to genes. Why do you believe in God? It's because it's in your genes. Why do I, somebody normally believe in God? It's because of his genes. So, you know, they just make genes the new omnipotent being. Actually, genes have no consciousness. Genes only determine biological structures within the body. Now, is there anybody who has not heard the word genes? I think all of you are from a reasonable scientific background. You don't have to remember about genes and everything. Just, it's something which determines hereditary characteristics. Hereditary characteristics means, it's generally the children have some characteristics which are similar to the parents. So, according to current science, that is caused by genes. So, the continuity of hereditary characteristics is fine. But there's a lot more to our personality than just our hereditary characteristics. Now, from the genetic point of view, Hiranyakashipu is a demon, why Prahlad becomes a devotee? You know? Actually, the mentality is different. And you know, there are serious problems in the genetic theory. There is something called, that in the documentary which I showed, so Ian Stevenson was speaking, and he spoke something, his pronunciation is not very good. So he is talking about how sometimes there are monozygotic twins who have entirely different behavior. Monozygotic means, twins, what happens is basically, when the sperm comes and unites with the egg, where with the in the womb, then the zygote is formed and it grows. Sometimes two sperms unite with two eggs and then two zygotes are formed. And that's how two twins are born. So this, in this case, the genetic content of the two twins is different. But in some cases, only one sperm unites and then after that it splits into two. When it splits into two, then after that twins are born. When the twins are born, these twins have entirely identical genetic content. And yet, they have radically different behavior. So he gives example in one of his books that how there was one twin who was a teetotaler. Teetotaler means he would not take any alcohol. And the other was a complete alcoholic addict. And both have entirely identical genes. So this is biologically unexplainable. So our point was that currently scientists try to find out, is there some gene which decreases the reproduction rate of the cells, and that's what causes death. So they did a lot of research. And they thought, maybe this is the gene. Then what they decided, if this gene is causing the cells to die out faster, we'll just remove that gene from the body. And they removed that gene from the body, and they found still the cells are dying. And they found maybe there's some other cell. And they removed that cell also. And now they found that actually it's very simplistic to ascribe one function to one gene. They say all the genes combine together to form all functions. So they just can't ascribe it. So there is an International Gerontological Association. Gerontology is the study of old age. So International Gerontological Association. So they published a paper in World Interest, in Public Interest. And they wrote in that paper that because there is so much advisement today, that you can grow young, you can do this, you can do that, there is so much treatment by which your old age can be removed. So they said, in a statement, that there is no technology, no mechanism, no medicine available today that can reverse, stop, or slow the aging process. That means, if they can't reverse it, that means they can't make old people young. They can't stop it. That means they can't prevent young people from becoming old. And they can't even slow it. And what can they do? Nothing. The only thing they can do is just do some plastic surgery or do some superficial things. So the idea of trying to attain genetic immortality has more or less been shallowed by science. Still, some scientists are looking for it. Another way they are looking for it is what I mentioned in yesterday's class. You know, what is that? Saving your body in the refrigerator and hoping that in future the body will be revived. So they have also done that for Einstein's brain. They have kept Einstein's brain preserved. They are hoping in future, through Einstein's brain, we will revive Einstein. So anyway, these are all strange ideas that they have. And the hope for immortality is very deep-rooted in the living being. And that is understandable because we are immortal. But that is not possible at the material level. In fact, you know, from the biological point of view, our desire for immortality itself is inexplainable. Because from the biological point of view, all our desires come from our circumstances. But they say, why do you believe in God? Because probably you saw people around you believe in God. Or, now, why do you like this particular food? Because people around you like that thing, so you like it. So they say all our desires come from our circumstances. But all around us, we see that nobody lives forever. And still we want to live forever. So where does our desire for immortality come from? Not only do we not see anybody living around us, so they say, according to current science, what is the source of our behavior? They say there are only three sources. It's genetic. Genetics is one source. Second is upbringing. And third is association, surroundings. So in our upbringing and association, we don't see anybody living eternally. And genetically speaking, our body is not made to be eternal. So then still, where does our desire for living forever come from? That modern science has no explanation. Darwin knows the idea that actually everybody wants to survive. When he says survival for the fittest, everybody wants to survive. But where does the desire for surviving come from? That they don't have much explanation. Yeah?
That explanation, once man mating egg and the biological matter turning into two, where does two soul come from?
I was thinking about that. Somebody should ask this question. See, where did the second soul come from? When the Bhagavatam describes Pravishta, what is that? Sriya Pravishta Udaram Pumsa Reta Kanashrayaha. That through the semen, the soul enters into the womb. That is not the only way things happen. That is the general way things happen. That is the typical way things happen. But that is not the only way things happen. So, the whole process of going from this body to next body is shrouded in mystery. Because that realm is ununderstandable to us. If we look at the union of Diti and Kashyap, it is described that union happened at an inappropriate time. And at that time, Lord Shiva's associates were wandering around. And at that time, the union was there. So, they injected these demoniac souls. So now, if the soul is going to come from Kashyap's semen, then how will the time make a difference at that time? This point, so actually speaking, that is the indicative way of how things happen. That is not the exclusive way things happen. There can be multiple ways also. Yeah? Do the cells in our body have souls? Prabhupada was asked this question. Prabhupada said, they may have many souls also. But the cell is not their body. They are germs who have their own bodies. It's not that every cell is animated by a soul. There is only one soul which animates the full body. But a cell can serve as a biological medium in which other organisms can live. So if there is a microbe in the body, then that microbe is a soul with its own body. And that is living inside the cell. That means the cell itself is not a body for a soul. All the cells in our body are the part of the body which is for the man's soul, which is you or me. But along with that, Prabhupada gives the example that just like you have a house. So it is your house and you are the main occupant of the house. But along with that, in your bedroom there may be some ants. In your kitchen there may be some mice. In your living room there may be a dog. They are all living together, but they are not the proprietors of the house. And the living room doesn't belong to the dog, and the bedroom doesn't belong to the mice, or whatever. So they are living because it's a suitable environment. They are souls and they have their own bodies over there. So like that, there may be some germs which infect our respiratory system. In the cells of the respiratory system, there may be many souls. But they are all souls with their own bodies. It's clear?
Yeah.
Yes. Now, artificial cell growth or cloning or stem cell research, all these things, they involve souls entering in abnormal ways. See, in general, the soul is always seeking a body. There are a lot of disembodied souls. And those disembodied souls, whenever they get a suitable biological medium, they occupy it. That's how they come in. Now the current fashion is what the vegan movement has raised a lot of objection to the slaughter of animals. So currently, through stem cell research, the researchers are trying to do, they just take a cell from a cow, and then they just make that cell grow into cow flesh. And they say, in this actually there is no torture, there is no torment, there is just creation of flesh. And they are trying to create in such a way so there are no bones, there are no horns. So we'll just have unadulterated flesh. But the whole thing is riddled with tremendous dangers. Apart from the ethical issues involved, when we play around with nature, like we had the experience with mad cow disease. You know, so there can be a lot of dangers which come up when we play around with nature. So actually in the whole field of genetics, a lot of playing around is happening. Stem cell research is one of those things. There are other researches also like that which are there. And there are ethical issues involved, but along with the ethical issues, there are also the health issues involved. Yeah, so separate souls came in over there. How it happened? No, so, as I said, souls are there in the atmosphere and the souls are trying to get bodies all the time. So as soon as suitable biological medium is there, they occupy that and they get the body. So now it is described that, if you look at it similarly in the Mahabharata, it is said that Dhritarashtra united with Gandhari once, and there was one lump of flesh there in her womb, and that came out when she hit it. And then it was cut according to the instruction of Vyasadeva. Then 100 Kauravas were born. That means 100 different souls entered over there. So the souls are there in the atmosphere, they are looking for biological mediums where they can get bodies. So wherever a conducive medium is there, there they will occupy the body. Viruses have life. I think such questions are taking the life out of many devotees here. I want to finish everything. Quickly I'll tell. See, out of these six characteristics, matter has these three. Depending on the karma of the soul is placed in a biological medium that exhibits more and more of these capacities or varying quantities of these capacities. So for example, one soul may get the body of a germ, another may get the body of a blue whale. Why is the difference? It's because of karma. But these three additional features that are there, they come because of the presence of a soul. So now virus, it is almost on the border of life and non-life. But it does exhibit the capacity of reproduction. And reproduction generally indicates the presence of a soul. Can I have the issue for 1 minute? Sambhutim cha vinasham cha yastad vedo bhayam saha. So basically how the purport is flowing, Prabhupada first tells that this world, you cannot be deathless. And then why do people try to be deathless in this world? Because they don't know that there is another realm of deathlessness. That's why they are trying to make this world deathless. But when you understand there is another world that is deathless, we will redirect our energy over there. And then Srila Prabhupada goes into elaborate description of the spiritual world. And after describing the spiritual world, then he contrasts the material world where there is repeated suffering and death. And then he says that the whole purpose of Vedic literature is to get us to that eternal goal. And then he concludes by saying that we have to give up misconceptions. Prabhupada's last paragraph is quite instructive. So second, just before the last paragraph, the sentence is, service rendered to the sense objects is both misleading and degrading. Two descriptions, misleading and degrading. Misleading means we are promised happiness but we don't get happiness. Degrading means it takes our consciousness down. And then Prabhupada says, we must therefore save ourselves and our fellow men in the right way. There is no question of liking or disliking the truth. It is there. He says, you may feel that this, I don't want to practice those things. It doesn't matter what we feel. if you want to be saved from repeated birth and death, what is it? Then we must take to the devotional service for the Lord. There can be no compromise, for this is a matter of necessity. Matter of necessity. That means, Srila Prabhupada is telling that, just like when a patient is diseased, and he has to take treatment to be cured. Sometimes people say, is spirituality optional? Yes, spirituality is optional, but suffering is compulsory. Suffering is compulsory in the material world. And if you want relief from suffering, then spirituality is compulsory. If you want to continue suffering, then spirituality is optional. So that's why Prabhupada said, it is a matter of necessity. If you want relief from suffering, it's a matter of necessity. And there's one point related with the similar verse which we went through, 11th verse. I'd just like to quickly go over that. Yeah. So basically, karma, jnana and bhakti. So karma and jnana are two extremes. Bhakti is the middle balance. Karma says, in karma, the path of karma, we abuse the senses for our sense gratification. In the path of jnana, we reject the senses. So there is disuse or no use of the senses. But in the path of bhakti, there is a right use of senses. So it's like the three extremes, three positions. Well, in karma, we think my senses are for my sense gratification. I will look at beautiful objects. I will touch soft objects. I will eat delicious objects. So that is abuse, because that leads to karmic bondage. And the jnani say, all the senses, reject them completely. Reject the senses. But then, so to use the senses is natural, but it is binding. So, you know, in the European logic, there were often the progression was through three levels. There was thesis, antithesis and synthesis. So thesis means what? This is what I say. So thesis may be something like God exists. So antithesis is God doesn't exist. These are just opposite propositions. Then synthesis is the idea, can you find a middle way which reconciles both? So now, of course, you cannot find that with respect to this thesis and antithesis. There is only one that is true. But there are other cases where if there are two opposing positions, one can take the strengths of both positions and integrate them. So in one sense, here, how should we live in the world? So thesis is karma. How should you live? Just act. That's natural for us. All of us, we want to speak, we want to walk, we want to go here, we want to enjoy our senses. So act with the senses. That's the thesis. So the thesis has a good point and a bad point. The good point is that it is natural. But the bad point is that it is binding. Then the opposite proposition is antithesis. That, hey, actually we should not act with our senses. If we act with our senses, there will be bondage. So then that is the opposite of karma. So now this is non-binding. It won't bind us. But it is, the problem with it is unnatural. It's unnatural to be inactive. But then the synthesis is what? Take the good points of both and bring them together. So act for Krishna's sake. Use your senses but to see the beauty of Krishna, to taste the prasad of Krishna, to serve Krishna. So when we do that, when there is synthesis, then we take the both. It is natural to act, so we act. But then it is not binding. Not only is it non-binding, it is liberating. So in this way, we can see bhakti logically integrates the good of both karma and jnana, and it rejects the deficiencies or limitations of karma and jnana. In this way, it brings both together. Okay. So let's go to verse 15 now.
Hiranmayena patrena satyasya pihitam mukham tattvam pushana pavruno satya dharmaya drishtaye.
O my Lord, sustainer of all that lives, your real face is covered by your dazzling effulgence. Kindly remove that covering and exhibit yourself to your pure devotee.
This is Srila Prabhupada is speaking based on the Jiva Goswami Tattva Sandarbha over here. This is a little technical. If we can understand the concept, it will not be very difficult. So basically, Jiva Goswami says how bhakti reveals the absolute truth in completeness. So first he says that in the path of Sankhya, when one starts analyzing, then one goes beyond the material forms to the material elements. This is a good pot, this is a nice flower, this is a good gulab jamun. You go beyond all these forms, they are all made of earth. So one tries to go to the root of reality. And in the process of going to the root of reality, one goes from material forms to material elements. So in Sankhya, the absolute truth is thought of as matter. Then one goes beyond Sankhya to Jnana. One starts thinking, actually, if the material elements are not the absolute truth, because all material elements are temporary, there has to be something more. Then one comes to the existence that is beyond matter. And one thinks, okay, matter is temporary, that existence must be eternal. So at that level, one understands the absolute truth as just existence. That's how Jiva Goswami uses the word absolute truth without potencies. Without potencies. That means Brahman is just plain existence. So in Jiva Goswami's Harinamamrita Vyakaran, he gives all the rules of grammar in terms of the names of Krishna. So he says, in Sanskrit, in English, there are two genders. There is masculine and feminine, male and female. But in Sanskrit, there is male, female and neuter. So he says, in Harinamamrita Vyakaran, Jiva Goswami says that he gives the masculine gender as the name Narayan. And the feminine gender, he gives the name Lakshmi. And the neutral gender, he gives the name Brahman. So, Brahman is napunsak or important. So, the absolute truth, Jiva Goswami, Harinamamrita Vyakaran. So absolute truth without potencies. The Brahman is just existence. There is no potency over there. Then he gives an interesting insight over here. In the path of yoga, there is absolute truth on the path of yoga, one realizes Paramatma. So that one realizes the absolute truth with material potencies. Why material potencies? Because at this stage, one understands that the absolute truth is the creator and controller of this world. But one doesn't think that the absolute truth has his own life and his own pastimes with his devotees. That's why one sees only the material potencies of the absolute truth. But when one practices bhakti, then one realizes Bhagavan has absolute truth with material and spiritual potencies. So in one sense, this is a progression of what I discussed in Om Purnamada Purnamidam, Satchitananda. But this is slightly additional insight is that there is material potencies and spiritual potencies being talked about. So this is what I just discussed. I showed how different paths culminate in bhakti. Bhagavan is the highest realization. This is talked about in Bhagavad Gita also in all these verses. Okay. So what we'll do is we'll stop a little early now. And we'll start a little earlier in the evening. I'll just quickly go over the purport. We'll stop in... Kiran Prabhu is here? Okay, any idea what time Prasadam will come? 1:15? So why I was thinking, I'm seeing that many of you are tired. Yesterday was a long festival. So I was thinking we'll stop now. And we'll continue afterwards. Maybe we'll take for around 2.5 hours if required in the afternoon. Can we start at 3:30? Can we stop now? 3:30 we'll start. 3:30 to 6 we can finish. So we'll stop now and we will continue at 3:30. We should be able to complete by 6 o'clock. Thank you very much. Shri Shopanishad ki, Shri Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhaktarinda ki, Jai Tai Gaur Premanand.